Hello all, welcome to the TetraCast, RPG Site's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Welcome back, everyone. I hope everyone had a great holiday break.
We have Mikhail Manani.
Caffeinated.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And Chow Min Wu.
I got killed by harpies.
Dragon's Dogma?
Oh, that's why Baldur's Gate 3 friends.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, so this is our first regular episode of the TetraCast for 2026. If you've been keeping up with the TetraCast, you last heard our RPG of the Year episode, which we published in the back half of December. Here we are, back in the new year. We are recording this on January 10th. Getting back into the normal swing of things. We're all back from break. We're going to talk about what we did over the last month. Obviously, we have a lot of news to catch up on. We haven't had a podcast recorded for the site since the Game Awards, so even though it won't be new news, we'll at least touch base on all the major announcements out of that. We'll look forward to, you know, games coming out in January, all sorts of things. So this will be a little bit more of a news-focused episode, but also we're going to go around, you know, the participants, talk about, you know, just generally what they did over the break, if they played anything, what they did outside of gaming, what they visited family, traditions, all those sorts of things. Also, just a small programming note, I am recovering from a cold, so if I sound a little dry, that's that. So I will just make sure to let others speak, make sure I don't cough into the microphone or anything like that. So I apologize if I sound a little bit off. But yeah, here we are, back in January. Maybe I'll just hand it off over to Adam. Like, 2026, RPGs, video games, how you feeling?
Should I talk about what I'm looking forward to or what I played over break?
Now let's talk about let's start off with, like, looking back, you know, well, let's talk about personally what we did over the break. Then we'll touch base on the site in terms of our RPG of the Year stuff, just very basic at a high level, because of course we have a full podcast to point back to on that. But yeah, we'll start with personal reflection and then we'll start with, and then we'll go into site stuff.
Yeah, so every year during, like, the Christmas, New Year's holiday, I go back to my parents' place for a week and a half, 2 weeks or so. And I usually try to bring along a game or two to kind of catch up on or play, maybe something out of the backlog. This year, I have two games that I played. One of them was Metroid Prime 4, not an RPG. It's one of those games, very briefly. I think it's fine. It's not a bad game, but I do think it's the worst Metroid Prime game due to some of the changes it makes, specifically with, like, the overworld and the green crystals and some of the structure stuff. It just didn't really work for me. I think it's okay. As far as RPGs go, you may remember that last year on, like, this, our first episode of 2025, the game that I talked about in this section, I actually talked about a handful of games. I talked about the Legend of Heroes Gaharv trilogy, because I had played, like, those PSP versions over the break. Not the greatest versions, but that actually kind of does tie into the next game I'm going to talk about. So I played those versions because they were the official English versions. I knew they aren't, like, considered by anyone the best versions. In fact, they're considered pretty shoddy. But someday, maybe 20 years from now, I'll maybe play better versions of those three games. But the game that I played this year when I went home for the holidays sort of fits in that same sort of, like, idea or concept. I played Tales of Phantasia Cross Edition. Are you familiar with what edition this is?
The PSP version, isn't it?
It's one of the PSP versions. I think there's two different PSP versions, because there's full voice edition, but then there's cross edition.
I think it's a last edition. It has, like, two games in one. There is, like, the cross dungeon in there, was it?
Yeah, so this is what it is. So anyways, how that ties back into what I was talking about with Legend of Heroes was, back in 2005 or whenever it was, I played the official English release of Tales of Phantasia, which was only the GBA version.
On the GBA, right? Yeah.
That's the only official English release. There was a phone release for a while, but that's no longer there. And that version is the only official English version, but it's also widely considered to be the worst for a handful of reasons. Obviously, it's got the very small screen. It has some infamous localization issues where, like, Ragnarok was translated as kangaroo due to
spelling. Wasn't it due to some sort of, like, find and replace in an Excel spreadsheet or something like that is what it ended up being?
Somebody ended up, that was, like, the, that was the theory for a long time, and people managed to find the version of, like, Office that would have been used around the time, and they put Ragnarok down in there, and it tried to autocorrect the kangaroos, so they confirmed, yep, that's exactly what happened.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So back then, almost 20 years ago, at that time, I was like, all right, someday I need to play a version of this game that's actually good. And now is finally that time. Finally. So I played the Cross Edition. The reason why I played this edition, this is the latest version of Fantasia, I think. The mobile version might have been later. It's close to that. It released in 2010. It was bundled with like Narkiri Dungeon Cross, which is sort of like a pseudo sequel to Fantasia. As far as I understand, it's similar to like Dawn of the New World in that it's like a sequel with monster catching and things like that. And some people just pretend it doesn't exist. But in that PSP sequel, they bundle Tales of Fantasia Cross Edition, which is just Tales of Fantasia with that battle system. And the reason why I picked that one was that, as far as I know, is the only version of the game that never will pause during combat for summons or spells or heals. And that's the version I want to go with. I do have some friends who believe this is the best version of the game. That's not universally agreed upon, but I decided, let me go with this one. And so I played through the game. I played through it just in Japanese. I don't understand Japanese, but I already know the story. I just followed some quick guides online just so I know who do I need to talk to progress and move forward. But otherwise, the games are pretty playable, even if you don't know the language, I think. For example, the menus have icons where like, oh, I can definitely tell this is an apple gel or this is a light bottle or whatever. So I know what items are what, even though I can't read it.
What better way to
there
learn?
There are some criticisms. Yeah. I kind of know what the words in Japanese for yes and no are because you just see those everywhere.
There you go.
I learned it when I was in like 10 years old playing the imported version of Final Fantasy VIII. I just look at two letters is yes, three letters is no.
Yes, it's backwards from English. But there are some criticisms for like, is the fact that the game no longer pauses better or worse? Like, I know there are some enemies that because the game no longer pauses, they're like easier to like stunt lock you. Or there's some skills like Lightning Tiger Blade that in the other versions, when you do it, the lightning will pause for a bit, which can be beneficial. And now it doesn't. Now it's just basically a smooth action. But I think those slight nitpicks are far outweighed by the fact that I never have to wait for Nurse from Mint to heal up or for Klaus to summon whatever he's doing or for Arch to do her summon. Or her spells. So it's similar to like Tales of Eternia on PSP in terms of that battle system and style. It looks like that. I wouldn't be surprised if it's the same engine and feels like that.
I was going to say, the thing I dislike about that game is that they didn't like correct all the animations. They just took some of the ones from the PlayStation version. And then some of the new sprites are like Eternia, where they're kind of skinny, and the PlayStation sprites are like fat-headed chibis compared to them. And it just looks kind of out of place with some of it. That's what I remembered. Unless that was the full voice edition. I'm trying to remember which one that was.
Yeah, as I understand it, the full voice edition on PSP released a little earlier, and that plays more like the PlayStation 1 version, but has voice acting. So this is the other PSP version that doesn't play like the PS1 version and still has voice acting. One thing about this game that I actually did not know, I think everyone who knows anything about Tales knows that like in the original Super Famicom version, you have five playable characters. Suzu is in the game but not playable, and then she was added in or as playable in the PlayStation version and every other subsequent version, like the Game Boy Advance version, right? I didn't actually know that the Cross Edition version actually has a seventh playable party member. I had no idea. It's Rondaline, which everyone's favorite Tales character, Rondaline.
If you told me right now that you're making this up, I'd be like, yeah, I can believe you. Like, I've never heard of this.
Yeah, so Rondaline, I gather, is a character from Narikiri Dungeon X or Cross, and she does like time travel stuff. And she kind of like, I think, pops in and out of time or whatever. And then so like she in this version, there's extra scenes with her where she just like pops into the storyline and there's extra scenes. And then she joins your party for a bit. I heard that she does feel pretty tacked on, which is not surprising. I don't really care. I couldn't even understand what the scenes were saying anyway. But she joined my battle party. Like, oh, I can play with her. That's
cool. Like a bonus. Don't think about it too hard type of deal. Yeah.
But otherwise, yeah, it was kind of a fun revisit of a game that I've been meaning to play a good version of Fantasia for a while, and now I finally did.
Nice.
Cool. My holiday break, this will be much shorter, because I had plans for the holiday break. I downloaded both Metroid Dread and Metroid Beyond to my Switch 2 to try to, like, all right, I'm going to knock these out over the break. That didn't happen. The last time we had a regular episode of the podcast, our main topic was Octopath Traveler Zero. And that's all I managed to complete over the break. But it's a long game, so like I'm not surprised, but most of my break was just tackling through that. I don't want to like cover that again too much, because that was the last topic we had on the regular episode of the Tetracast. But I enjoyed it a lot. Like, it's very different from a traditional Octopath game, but I really quite loved Octopath Traveler Zero. So I'm sure we'll be talking about that more at the end of 2026, because that's kind of the year we're going to bundle it into for our site's purview. But yeah, my break was Octopath Traveler Zero. The only other game I started was I want to complete Rise of the Ronin before Neo 3. So that's what I'm in the middle of now.
Cool.
There's a lot about it I don't like, but yeah. I don't want to be too negative about it.
No, I understand.
It's fine, but I can see why it didn't really make a splash when it
for sure.
It'll be interesting to see. We've talked about, of course, Neo 3 being open world, borrowing from the groundwork that was set with Rise of the Ronin. So I think in February we'll probably be making that comparison again, in a more detailed fashion in that context. So that was my break. How about you, Josh?
Yeah, my break was pretty chill and interesting. Like, last time we had the podcast, like early December, I was talking about reading this visual novel, part one of this trilogy called Kara no Shoujo, which was localized over as The Shell from Shiravune when they took over the rights of, you know, kind of remastering that trilogy and putting it on Steam and so forth. And I did something that I haven't done in a really long time, where usually, like, years and years ago, I would usually like devote, like, say, summer breaks from school to just sometimes reading only like a visual novel for like a month or like half a month or something. I haven't done that in a really long time. So from December 1st all the way to January 1st, the only game I really played was this Kara no Shoujo, The Shell trilogy of visual novels. So I finished the final part three, like the true ending of it, on January 1st, like early in the morning. And like, I was super blown away, because people, I probably mentioned this like last time on the podcast too, where a lot of visual novel readers in that community really have like a high respect for this trilogy of visual novels, and widely considered like masterpieces in the whole visual novel sphere. And like, I get it. I understand why these stories, like some of the most captivating tales I've ever read, but it's one of those things that, like, I you know, if you're interested in going into it, know what kind of content it has. It's very graphic in a lot of ways, because your main character is a detective investigating grisly serial murders like in mid-1950s Japan. Like, there's a lot of very graphic content, especially when you're going on investigating the crime scenes, and they don't really hold back with, like, sort of like the gore, the disgustiness, disgusting like states that the bodies and corpses are in. Like, it's very graphic both in the text and the visuals in that regard.
Just a question. I remember I was playing this one visual novel way back a long time ago. It was called Gore Screaming Show. I was a kid or something. And there was like all these like scenes where like all the girls get like brutally murdered, and it was like censored in Mosaic.
There's patches for Shiravune like that, like kind of unlock like the full game. I don't know like how censored it is, which we just like boot them up without like the uncensored full game patch. You know, like it does that thing where you download the game from Steam, then you go to Shiravune's site and like download a patch to put into the game installation folder, and that unlocks like the whole thing. I don't know exactly how much of the game is like locked off, or you know what you're missing out on if you don't do that. Like a whole manual patch thing, the drag and drop. It's very simple, but I don't know exactly what is barred off, because I don't really care.
You just did it.
Yeah, I just did it because I was
like, "Makes sense." I'm gonna do the same game when I get to it. So
it's a really, really, really interesting tale that like the whole the revolving theme around it is just people who are like kind of strangled by their obsession. Whether it's an obsession of like, you know, saving someone or like there's a memory that they want to hold on to, and the different ways that obsession kind of manipulates and groups people and how it affects people around them. It's such a really, really, really good story that like that will probably stick with me for the rest of my life.
What was the name of it again?
Kara no Shoujo, and then the localized title is like The Shell. So like if you go to Steam, it's like The Shell Part 1 Inferno, The Shell Part 2 Purgatorio, and Part 3 Paradiso. So really, really good. Other than that, a few days ago, I saw it on sale on the holidays. I picked up Koei Tecmo's and developed by Omega Force this little game called Warrior's Abyss. And it's like basically a small passion project from a team at Omega Force that kind of did a roguelite of like the Dynasty Warriors Orochi series. So they have characters from Dynasty Warriors 8 Extreme Legends, Samurai Warriors, even some crossover Koei Tecmo characters that they added on in free updates, like Atelier series, like with Ryza, Sophie, and Yumiya. They added Ninja Gaiden characters like Ryu and Momiji, and some other characters here and there. So there's like a massive roster, but it's a really, really cool, small, like, roguelite that kind of encapsulates the feeling of like playing a Warriors Musou game from an isometric perspective, with like some of the systems that you would go through a roguelite, like upgrading your moveset, upgrading like your assist characters, and different elemental powers and synergies. That's actually just like a fun thing to kind of just burn some time on and just see, hey, this is a really cool thing that they produce and continually update. Like it was like not too long ago, like they did like a whole balance patch that buffed a lot of characters. Like they've been continually improving that game since launch. And like, I just never, you know, got onto it until now. It's like, that was cool. That's a really cool experience. And one other release I started playing that's actually a new release this year in 2026 called Vital Shell. And it's like a small, I believe, solo project that's also basically kind of like roguelite, sort of Vampire Survivors-esque, but it's a bit more heavily involved with its progression systems where, you know, you have this robot that's one out of like 5 playable robots that you unlock as you progress through the game. And they have like different sorts of like guns and types of weapon attributes to those guns that you upgrade their attack power, attack speed, and all sorts of like different abilities for them, along with like a boost and like an ultimate weapon that you unlock that's, you know, like kind of well made for what it is. It's really going for that like PlayStation 1 era-esque visuals, polygonal visuals, and even like the main menu is very PlayStation 1-esque with like a rotating circle. And then like even when you're saving, for example, it has like the PS1 memory card, and like when you're looking at the controls of the game, like one of the graphics of the controls is like the PS1 controller. Even without the analog sticks, it's just like the normal PS1 controller. It was really funny to see. I was like, man, this is a really of an era that I respect that this developer is going for. And other than that, I also am starting to like, I'm marathoning this show called To Be Hero X that premiered last year that a friend of mine had been trying to get me to watch. And it's a really also like interesting, like, show about like superheroes, but the way that the framework that it's put in is that people can be heroes if people trust you enough, and it's called like a trust value. So people's like perception of you as a hero manifests into you, like your superpowers, and how society drastically changed, like the dynamics of society are drastically changed because of that whole trust value system of like, hey, people's perception of you can radically alter your lifestyle, both for better or for worse. Like, for example, like people that, like, there's this character, this firefighter that saved this young girl, and that was televised. So people got a lot of trust. Like, man, this guy's like standing tall, standing firm. He won't ever like you know, he won't, he'll stand tall to, like, you know, evil doers. So how that manifests in his superpowers is, like, he's super strong, but he can no longer bend down because people's perception of him is that he can't, he'll always stand tall and stand firm. So that's, like, he's built as, like, a tank, but because of people's perception of him as that, he can't bend down. So you see, like, this horrific lifestyle alteration that he's had to go through, like, where he can't even, like, go to bed horizontally. He has to go on a stand-up bed and, like, belt himself to that bed because he can't bend down anymore because of people's trust value in him to grant him his superhero power. Just, like, a very small tidbit like that. It's like, wow, that's a pretty insane, interesting way to, like, frame, like, that superhero.
I wasn't expecting it to be so literal. What I was expecting was something like, probably on the same page, was someone who has a lot of trust from, like, the populace, but isn't necessarily, like, actually, like, a good person or a well-meaning person, and that makes them dangerous, you know, because they have all this power from this trust value because it is bestowed upon them, even though they aren't using it for, you know, righteous or real reasons or correct reasons. Or on the flip side, if you are mistakenly lose trust in people, you're framed or whatever. I'm hypothetically thinking you could lose power.
Yeah, that's very much explored in the show, like both of these scenarios, and like just like how this fluctuate the nature of fluctuations of, like, just like maybe one bad scandal, you know, for example, will lose, like, you know, the populace's trust in you, so your powers dwindle or even, like, you know, disappear almost overnight because of, like, say, one bad, really bad scandal, for example. It's like, it's a really interesting, like, just way to perceive that sort of superhero almost trope, but it's a really fascinating show that apparently, like, three entire studios, like, different studios worked on, because, like, it does shift between different art styles throughout the show. Like the main first arc is, like, mainly, like, almost Pixar CG, but then another arc will shift to, like, more, like, you know, 2D anime-esque storyboarding sort of stuff like that, and even it will even, like, intermingle with those styles mid episode. So it's, like, a really, really interesting way that, like, they tell this tale along with the stylistic shifts that they tell this tale in. And it's, like, it's from different, like, as you grow through the show, it's, there's no central main character. It's like you'll go through this person's arc, and then the next thing, like, hey, it's a different character that's loosely maybe introduced or seen in that other person's story arc, but now you're looking at their origin story and, like, what they went through to get to where they are, and where they, how their life has shaped society in, like, climbing up the ranks of this hero ranking and people's trust in them. So it's such a cool show. And yeah, that was my break.
James, I know before we left for break, you talked about your plans were circled around Final Fantasy XIV and rating. Is that where it ended up, or do I have my time? So
that's basically what I've been doing this week. In fact, I can't stay for the whole podcast this week because we're raiding more tonight. So, yeah, I'm on the final fight of the tier, still on pace to get a week one clear for the whole tier this week. So, having a good time, very tired. But also, outside of 14, at the very tail end of last year, I still don't know how it happened, but I committed to a bit where I'm playing and streaming every single 2022 Square Enix release that's not Babylon's Fall, because I can't play that anymore.
I have the platinum trophy for that.
Oh my god.
I'm very proud of that.
What are the 2022 releases? Like, remind me. Like, I'm thinking, is that, like, Stranger of Paradise? Or
Stranger of Paradise is one of them. Crisis Core Reunion is one of them. Harvestella is one of them.
Oh, that's a fun one.
Various Day Life's non-Apple Arcade release is one of them. Most of the Voice of Cards games are part of that. So I'm just doing the full Voice of Cards trilogy since I can't do Babylon's Fall. And, like, the first one was technically the tail end of 2021. But, yeah, so...
Was 2022 the year that they released like a game every 3 weeks? Is that what kind of that?
Yeah, yeah. Like there's like Triangle Strategy was 2022. Like Star Ocean Divine Force was one. Dragon Quest Treasures was one. Chocobo GP. There was a lot of games.
Valkyrie Elysium.
People talked about how like from 2021 through 2023 they released far too many games, and like 2022 was just the quintessential. How did they expect any of these games to do well in isolation? So, yep.
So which one were you playing first?
I did Crisis Core. Streamed it. And yeah, next one after I'm done with the big 14 raid stuff is Chrono Cross Rival Dreamers Edition.
Chow was disgusted. Like
Can you not, man?
Harvestella, like my friends and I have been getting big into just regular Stardew Valley over the last couple months. We play it like once a week, and it's a great game. Not a game we talk about on the podcast, and it's been out for, you know, a while now. And it's actually kind of given me a little bit of that. You know what, Harvestella, that was an interesting, but a game that I think pretty fondly on.
Yeah,
don't think I have the time or Kirby to like revisit it, but what a game.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting being removed from that whole 2022 Square Enix era for about 3 years now, and like seeing like, man, like, you know, these weren't all like fucking amazing games, but they were certainly interesting. It just kind of sucks that like Square Enix's like strategy to release them just, you know, obviously didn't pan out. Everyone's left cold, I guess, because now we're not in this weird Square Enix era where you don't really see much of them anymore. I mean, you do see like the big release here and there, but obviously they have learned a lot of like hard lessons from that. And I kind of wish that the lessons that they took out of that was like, still make these kinds of games, but kind of space them out and give them proper support in like building them up and marketing them better, you know? Like,
I kind of wish that was a takeaway. That's my opinion. This didn't give them like enough room to start cannibalizing their own sales.
They said that themselves.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
My 30 whatever year old brain isn't working. What was that strategy game that they released? Diofield Chronicle. I had to think about it.
Diofield.
Yeah. That was also 2022, right?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of excited to try that, because apparently like they added in a hard mode that actually, like, everyone I know that's actually played it has said that the normal difficulty was just too easy.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And they did some bold things with the story there, but I still always go back to when they overtook their socials with one of the characters, and it like did not land, like in terms of like being a fun idea.
Oh, it's really Walter Quinn. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a name.
But yeah. All right. What about you, Mikhail?
Like, just before getting to what I did over the break, if you remember when we did the Game of the Year podcast and the podcast before that, I said I was going to play 100 Line, and I played like 120 hours of that in like 3 or 4 weeks or something. And I took a break. I needed a break from that. Then I was like, I need to, since we have like a decent break, I think it was December 16th or 17th, whenever it was, there were like 2 weeks where I decided to like take a proper break, so I needed to organize my games, and like basically I just needed to organize one room at home. So I got down a lot of stuff from the attic. I got out a lot of IKEA storage boxes, and I was spending like most of my time doing that, labeling stuff, putting stuff up, throwing away boxes. I had like iPad box, like my dad's iPad box from 2015 or something, still in like one of the cupboards for some reason. So just dumping all of that stuff. And while I was taking breaks from that, I decided to start a new save in Cyberpunk 2077. Nice. And I played like, so what happened around that time is I ended up getting a review code for Factorio on Switch 2 as well. And this is a game I hadn't played much like before at all, except for a demo. So I ended up playing like 35 or 40 hours of Cyberpunk and like 25 or 30 hours of Factorio in the holiday break while doing all this organizing and moving. I don't want to talk about Factorio too much right now, but I will say that I'm very impressed with what they accomplished with the Switch 2 version of that. It's a fantastic game as well. And yeah, so Cyberpunk, this was super funny because why Cyberpunk? When I finished 100 Line, I just had this feeling I need to play something else, but I didn't want to play something similar. And I was just looking at what I should play, and I never finished Phantom Liberty despite like having it, playing it, testing it and stuff. I was like, screw it, I want to play from the start, not load an old save, you know, like not have to redo. They added a patch in the middle where they reset your abilities, right? I think that was the 2.0 big update they did for Cyberpunk, which people consider like the turning point for that. So I was like, screw all that, let me actually start from the beginning again and like play through it properly, patched out, and see how things go. Mostly enjoying it, playing as a female Vi, because I didn't do that before, and Shirami Lei voice acting is fantastic. I've also been listening to new radio stations and just playing quite differently, so it's surprising how different the game feels now and how different it sounds also, because like I'm just focusing on completely different things. But the funniest thing that's happened so far is after you finish, like I saw some discussion about Act 1 on Blue Sky and stuff, but there's a mission after that where you have to, like, Judy accompanies you on this thing where you're going to a Ripper dock, and there's one scene where you can either, like, you know, you can go all guns blazing and just shoot everyone, or you can let her distract them. And at this point, I think it was like 2 a.m. or something, I was like, you know, screw this, I just want to finish it. I just went and shot everyone in that Ripper dock thing. But then Judy was like stuck in air, like floating, and I was like, what is going on? Like, can I move her or something? I waited 15 minutes, nothing happened. I checked online. I got linked to this Reddit post from 5 years ago where people were complaining about the bug. It had commenced from a few months ago where people had the same bug on Switch 2. And this reminded me of exactly the same thing that happened in The Witcher 3, where I was playing it on Switch 1 and I ran into a bug where someone just got stuck in the air in a quest. And it was an issue which was like from day one, which they hadn't fixed. So that was absolutely like funny, because I was like, this is exactly the same feeling I'm getting as when I played The Witcher 3. So yeah, I have played a lot of Cyberpunk. I will probably finish off a whole playthrough of this game by the end of the month. And besides that, I got sent review codes. Like, I'll have my reviews out in a few days for the Switch 2 versions of System Shock Remake and Warhammer 40k Rogue Trader. Both of them were rushed for the holidays because they were abysmal at launch. There have been some improvements and stuff, but yeah, these, like, I genuinely am shocked that some of the, like, Rogue Trader's initial release, I'm shocked Nintendo even approved it. It's probably like the worst Switch 2 port I've played, period. So yeah, it's, I don't know what they're doing, and this is an after a patch also, it's not great. But yeah, like, I'll have my reviews out for those in a few days. Kind of disappointing end to the year, because so many, I've used my Switch 2 more than every other platform, so many good ports, and I ended the year, like, technically I ended it with Cyberpunk because like I was playing it there also, and PS5 because it has cross save. But yeah, it's unfortunate that like Rogue Trader is such a great game.
Factorio, Cyberpunk,
yes. Cyberpunk, I was like swapping between Switch 2 and PS5, but the others were all on Switch 2 because like there were also the Yakuza ports which came in. They did these like bizarre things where they released them like 1 month early on Switch 2, and then they just, like, you remember what happened, right? They delisted the old pages on Steam, which had like thousands of positive reviews, and they have like these new versions which people are not happy with for whatever reason, or people are just angry that they replaced the old version and stuff. So I have those also like on the plate to do. And then like lots of stuff randomly happened over the holidays, like that Persona 3 Reload port that just, like, the patch that just dropped and stuff. But the main thing is like organizing one room at home and Cyberpunk 2077, which I focused most of my whatever I could on. And I'm very happy I'm playing Cyberpunk on a new save again. I think I'm enjoying it more than The Witcher 3, which I think is one of my favorite RPGs in like ages. So I want to see how I feel about the ending, what ending I get. I don't even remember what original one I got, and how Phantom Liberty lands, because by all accounts, Phantom Liberty is like way better. So
Factorio, just curious, mouse controls at all or no?
So Factorio, I didn't know it was on Switch 1 until I got a review code for the Switch 2 version. It's like a cross-gen thing. So it has full mouse controls, and it has full touchscreen support, and it has full controller support. And I was reading like dev blog posts where the dev said that they didn't have Rumble in the PC version and they didn't have like controller support. But because they liked how HD Rumble was on Switch, they implemented like this very detailed thing where like basic stuff, like when you're mining different things, they have different rumble and stuff like that. So what I've been doing is when I play handheld, I've been using touch controls and like the Joy-Con, like normal controllers. But when I play docked, I've been using mouse controls. It works really well. The biggest surprise is it actually loads like very complex maps and holds the frame rate. So like kudos to them for that port. Like I'll probably be playing it more this month, but I didn't buy the DLC, which is supposed to be incredible. Like, have you played that? I don't know if you played Factorio. Okay.
For Factorio, I hear that it's basically like those that love to optimize their farm in Stardew but don't want to talk to the villagers, just go play Factorio. You don't have to be social at all. Just build your farm.
And I'm glad you brought that up because around the time Factorio released on Switch 2, there's this other game which got ported to Switch and Switch 2 called Little Rocket Lab. And this is exactly like a sort of like baby's first Factorio meets like Stardew Valley, or like, you know, these life simulation games where you like care about the NPCs, the townspeople, you bond with them. So they literally like funny you brought that up, because it's literally Little Rocket Lab is this indie game from No More Robots that is taking bits from Factorio and bits from like Stardew Valley life sims. And yeah, that's also pretty good. But I did pause playing that because you know how on the Switch or Switch, like on handhelds, when you put a game into sleep mode or you suspend, it's supposed to pause the game. What happened over here is when I did that, when the doorbell rang and I came back, it said you were exhausted, and I found out this does not pause when you suspend the game. So I'm like, I'm not playing this until they fix that. So yeah, that's an interesting tangent. But yeah, like Factorio, fantastic port so far. The only reason I'm not buying the DLC is because I have too many like ports to like write about on RPG side, and I literally do not want more distraction right now. So that's what I did.
Ciao, you're up. Last one.
Last one. Okay, wow. I've been playing Trails Beyond Horizon. Okay, but I'm just saying, I've been doing guide work, as usual, but I always constantly getting distracted. I end up playing Emerald Dragon on the PC Engine. I'm sure Adam played the Super Nintendo version back in the day and talked about it in podcasts, but the PC Engine is probably everyone's favorite definitive version of Emerald Dragon. It's a very old JRPG made in, like, 1989 on the PC 88, and then it was ported...
What is...
Emerald Dragon?
Was it? Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't know if you're still talking about that or another game. Go ahead.
Yeah. That's it. It was a JRPG that was made in, like, for the PC 88. So it's a very old game, right? It was made in 1989, right? But it was like way ahead of its time when it came out, because the game has like a party chat system. Like every time you get lost, you could talk to your party members and they'll talk, but most of the time they just kind of point you where to go. But yeah, it stands out for its time. So I was playing like PC Engine version because I finally got an English translation. I played it back in the day and I thought the game was epic because, you know, it's really cool. It has like this cutscene that looks cool. It's like, and now you can finally, you know, understand every single word. Like, obviously I know like a little bit of what's going on back in the day, but now you kind of got the whole picture, right? So I was distracted playing that. I'm going to get a lot of names kind of botched up in here in this game, because a lot of the character names have like Persian names. So I messed it up. That's kind of like on me. I don't know how to pronounce like half these Persian names. So like the premise is like somebody like spread a curse in the land that will cause all dragons to die. So you had like this intro cutscene, you just can see like these dragons that are like supposed to be the apex nature just melts into like into a skull. Like they just die just from living in land, right? So they had to get the hell out of there. Like they live in some pocket dimension place called Dragalia or something. I don't know. That's apparently what they call it in PC Engine. In the old version, they didn't even have a name for it. And somehow this ship gets shipwrecked and they find a girl there that has amnesia. And they find a dragon that's close to her age, and they were kind of raised together. So this girl is called Tamarin, and the main character's name is Atarushin. So they basically grow up as like, you know, like childhood friends, lovers, etc. But you know, she feels kind of out of place because she's a human, and
he's a dragon, so she decided to go back to the human world. But before she does that, the main character like breaks off his horn, saying that if you're ever in danger, please blow the horn and I'll come rescue you. And that's kind of like the premise of the game, right? She kind of goes into the human world, and the main character, you know, hears the horn, and they tell him, it's like, hey, well, you go to find her and see what the problem is, right? So that's kind of like the premise of Emerald Dragon, right? I still don't think, like, was it like the best version is out there? I think the FM Town version is the best version, but there's no English translation for that, and I'm sure nobody has an FM Town, which is kind of like this PC that was released in Japan, so.
I'm looking at the Wikipedia image of this right now. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. It literally looks like just like a Steam box only from 30 years ago. 40 years ago, yeah. I guess, almost at this point.
Yeah, like, I'm still kind of sad that there isn't, like, the best version. And also, like, all the versions have, like, little different story changes and different voice actors. Like, if you love 80s mecha anime, you'll be familiar with the cast of these characters. Like, the main character would be voiced by Camille from Zeta Gundam in the FM Town version. And while the PCN version, he's cast by, like, what is that? Raw's voice from Gundam Seed, like the main bad guy, instead. So it's like they have different casts of characters, and I think that also the reason like I like the PC Engine version is the main girl's voiced by I forgot her voice actress name, but it's like Ishtar from Macross 2. It's like she's like one of the goat like voice actress, but you don't see her doing like too many roles, but she's there. So if you love like 80s mecha anime, it's like you'll love like the voice cast of these characters. So that's also the reason why I play this game back in the day, because it has an awesome JP cast if you love 80s stuff, right?
I just want to say, yeah. I love how on brand this is for you so far right now.
I have a general question. Are there any RPGs that are both on Super Famicom and PC Engine where the Super Famicom version is better? Does that exist? No. Or the PC Engine version is just always better?
Always. But, you know, they're different. I mean, the Super Nintendo version has some bits that you could say it's better. Like, some people don't like the PC Engine version of Emerald Dragon because the overworld map is huge. Basically, it's like the entire game is like a dungeon, right? Instead of like, oh, now we cut out this forest and it just becomes like overworld map thing in the Super Nintendo version. So some people don't like the PC Engine version for that because it's too big, right? But there are some things like I do like better in like the FM Town version. So like, okay, let's say you rescue Tamarin, which is very early in the game, right? In the game, you basically like find her horn in this palace, find your horn in this palace, and then you find out you caught in a booby trap, and you kind of turn into your dragon form, break her out of there, right? Obviously, the dragon form has a curse on you, so you're like, oh, you're already dying. And the maker is like, oh, man, this is so pathetic. I was trying to act cool and trying to get you out of there, right? That's kind of like the PC Engine version, how you rescue Tamarin, right? But in the FM Town version, he just kind of goes to her house and just has like a very nice chat with her. And I actually prefer the nice chat over the him breaking out her from this prison, because it seems kind of dumb that she got captured in this prison, or she fell in a trap and get captured in this like prison. It makes kind of no sense. I actually prefer like them just talking in her house and making her like, hey man, there's like the food, like human food's really good. It's like I actually like that scene. It's more romantic and them just having a nice chat together, right? But there are some like changes in like both version. Like in the PC version, like the old PC version, the main character's already human. So you're like, what the hell? Why is there this main character's a human, right? And then he kind of explains to you he got a silver scale that lets him turn into a human later, talking to Tamarin, right? While the newer version, they added like this entire like backstory on how he becomes a human before he goes into his adventure, right? So it's a lot different, right? But and also the old PC version is actually a very hard game, because like in the old version, like you literally have to play perfectly. Because in this game, it's like, anybody, a party member gets KO, it's game over. Not just the main character. Because I think in the PC Engine version, only the main character gets KO'd, it's game over. But in the old PC version, like, anyone dies, it's game over.
That's pretty brutal. Fuck.
And the worst part is, you can only control the main character. The main character is... everyone else is, like, AI controlled. So if you're playing, like, the old PC version, it's like, oh, yeah, look at this guy. Bossum's gonna act like an idiot, and he's gonna charge in the front. And it's like, oh, what do I do, right? And there's also some, like, very stupid, like, mechanics in the old PC version. Where... Tamarind only has like 4 spells that they can learn or they can keep. And once she gets like over leveled, she gets like these like super laser attacks, but she lost her healing ability. So you're like, oh no, she doesn't heal anymore.
Nice.
Huge. So you're like, it's like, oh man. But yeah, that's kind of like Emerald Dragon. Like, I love this game and I will always recommend people to play it. But, you know, it's a product of its time, right? So I'm not sure people would. Going to dive into like a 90s RPG playing stuff like that, right?
Yeah, I played the Super Nintendo version. At some point, I'll play the PC Engine version.
Yeah. But yeah, I love Emerald Dragon. I keep getting distracted not doing my guide work and playing this. So that's on me.
Well, what guide are you on the hook for?
Is it Beyond the Horizon? Is that the guide you're working on?
Yeah. And the other thing I was doing was Baldur's Gate 3. A friend invited me to join a session with. It's more like random. It's like, oh yeah, we were watching anime together. We were watching Genosia. Yeah, that's our. And we're
nice.
Like, hey, well,
good choice.
Yeah, it's like we were. I was playing that, and or I was watching that. Then I played the game for the first hour, just to see the difference. It's like I feel like the anime version is like more exaggerated on the character traits, probably because there is no voice acting in the visual novel, so a lot of characters are kind of open to interpretation. Like I think SQ in the anime is like so exaggerated compared to lots of reading for the visual novel.
There's a different medium difference, right? Because they like the visual novel is like kind of like almost like a Japanese indie project. So they had like, you know, limited budget, limited resources.
Yeah, developing. It's like, so yeah, when they go from these two things, like they feel so different, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, so we were watching that Genosia, and my opinion is Rakyu is the ultimate clown. This they always die in first turn or something like that because they're passive aggressive. and it's like, oh yeah, and they're part of the intelligence department, which is the worst part. It's like, you're supposed to be smart. Why do you always die first? Oh, anyways, that's my Genosia experience. But yeah. They invited me to play Baldur's Gate 3. We're not too far in. We're only like 6 hours in. Characters are still level 3. This is like my first Baldur's Gate experience, so it's kind of new to me.
Cool.
They said that I picked some very bizarre choices. Because me and this other friend is playing blind, and one friend already beat it. So he kind of is kind of like a veteran, right? He won't like do anything. He will just let us make the choices, right? And he said that my choices are very blunt, not choices I would do that he would normally do. Like that, right?
Very quickly, like kind of like give us like a sum of like what your sort of build is at the moment. Like, what are your tactics? Are you more of like ranged or melee? Like,
I play like an idiot. I don't know what the gameplay is, so uh-huh. I play a like dark main.
What's your build? I play an idiot. There you go.
Nice. That's a good answer.
I play like an idiot. Okay, I play a dark domain cleric, and I always charge in head first.
Nice. That's kind of like the nice thing about D&D. It's flexible enough to know to stay. Playing suboptimally is kind of the best way to play it.
So that's my build. I'm a dark domain cleric. I always charge in head first. I think there was like one scene where I get like tackled on by Asterion, and I try to like headbutt him and like fight him, and it goes to like this dice roll, and I always win all my dice roll, and everyone's like, man, you're taking some high risk. And then there was like
I play like an idiot, but I get all nat 20s.
That's a classic D&D trope, like the newcomer who's just fucking lucky all the time.
And then there was like one part, I think it was like, I think we went to the place with like the thieves or something. I think like there was like these two thieves or something, and they're like, it's like, what you doing? I'm just like, browsing, and I had to fight them because those guys think I was trying to rob them, and then I knock on like their hideout, and I chose the choice of like, I'm gonna kill all of you. It's like, damn, it's like, why did you do that? It's like, I thought that's what we were supposed to do, because since we already killed our friends.
That's fun. That's a lot of fun. That's cool.
And that's kind of like that. And then we got killed by these herpes. They just, as soon as we walk in there, it's like all our characters just got, like, lured by their lullaby, and then we just all die. So we came back in level 3 and just killed them, and that's where we end our session, right? Cool.
That's awesome.
So that's my Christmas holiday.
Well, I think that kind of went through everyone what we were doing personally all over the break. As for RPG site, obviously I can point you to our big Game of the Year podcast where we sat down for 7 hours, the six of us plus Alex Donaldson, to determine our RPG of the year for the site for last year. So if you haven't listened to that, there's a week's worth of listening for you waiting there. Updates to that, things that weren't, I don't believe, published at the time, but are now since published going into 2026, is we have the readers' choice, you know, their vote for their favorite RPGs of 2025, as well as our staff and the readers' most anticipated RPGs for 2026. So for the readers, the selection for our, and shout out to Adam for kind of digesting all of the poll results and, you know, detailing out all of the statistics into our results page up on the site, rpgsite.net. We talked about how a lot of the vote getting was very, very close, where for the readers for RPG Site, favorite RPGs 2025, Clair Obscur did come out in top, but just behind it by percentage points was Trails in the Sky, first chapter, landing in second. Rounding out the top 10, a lot of the same games that were in our top 10, a few different, including position 3, 100 Line, ended up the readers' third favorite RPG of 2025. Digimon Story, Xenoblade Chronicles Cross Definitive, Deltarune showed up in the readers' list. Dragon Quest 1 and 2 HD 2D, Final Fantasy Tactics, Kingdom Come Deliverance, and Fantasy Life I. For most anticipated for the site, and we're going to be talking about these games throughout the year as we get into them, our winner, one of the early releases of 2026, is Dragon Quest 7 Reimagined, releasing in February. We're going to go into, of course, the since-announced demo for that game people have been playing through. Other high vote-getters for the site for 2026 anticipated RPGs are games like Nioh 3 and Fire Emblem Fortune's Weave. We've got the full list up on the site. For the readers most anticipated, we've got Fire Emblem and then Trails Beyond the Horizon, a January release that we're going to be talking about in not too long. So all of those all of those articles are up on the site, RPG Site Not Dead. Adam, are there any highlights for any of these kind of end of year or looking into 2026 features that you wanted to touch on? Because you were the primary force that that put these together for us.
I think for the last 3 years, our pick for RPG of the year has matched the readers. Not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. We're just normies now. We used to pick avant-garde choices. It was Baldur's Gate 3, Metaphor of Fantasio, and then Clair Obscur. I'm joking.
And Baldur's Gate, right?
Yeah, Baldur's Gate 2-3 years ago, Metaphor of Fantasio 2 years ago, and Clair Obscur last year. So yeah,
3 years. Yeah, I see what you mean. Okay. For us, it was between Clair Obscur and Kingdom Come, where for the readers, it was between Clair Obscur and Trails first chapter. Games like 100 Line showed up high on the readers list, didn't show up higher on our list, but we've already kind of gone into detail about, you know, all of the different boundary conditions that go into how those lists end up being ordered in the way that they are. But it's then, and that's why we publish both separately, right? So, and then of course, the last but not least, a lot of our contributors to the site, including Josh, myself, Mikhail, Dave and James and others, all have put together personal top 10 lists up on the site. So if you organize by feature, you see what we have kind of flagged under our branching path kind of tag, all of our personal top 10 lists for 2025. I think we have six or so of those put up on the site in late December, early January as well. I think with that, we can go into kind of our different features up on the site from December and January. I'm going to start out with, since I know that James has limited time with, you know, how long he's able to be on this podcast episode, different features that you put up on the site over the last, I guess, month and some change. So you have done a few things, including the Pokemon Legends Mega Dimension review. You had a few preview and interview opportunities here. I guess I'll let you decide. You mentioned at the start a Code Vein 2 preview opportunity. What did you have any like preference here about what you wanted to go into? What you're able to put together over the last month?
But yeah, like around the Game Awards, there was a preview opportunity to play a couple of hours of Code Vein 2. And like I say, my preview, I was someone that very quickly kind of bounced off the original Code Vein for a variety of reasons. I think the main thing was is that it never really felt good to play. It always felt like just a step, removed from feeling good to me, like in terms of controls. And like first and foremost, like Code Vein 2, from what I've played, the controls feel great. It feels way more responsive, and the boss fights that I went up against in that demo, the boss fights themselves felt really, really well designed. And it's making me actually pretty excited for this, because like you make the combat feel just that bit better. You make the boss fight scene like feel just that bit better. And it feels like Code Vein was one of those games that, for me at least, was super close to being good. And Code Vein 2 feels like it might have just crossed that threshold where it's like, okay, this is something I'll actually be able to really enjoy, at least in comparison to the original release. I am a bit worried about performance. I mentioned the preview that it's like when you play something for preview, you can't be sure how things are going to hash out with the final game. But it was kind of noteworthy where so many people in this call have seen the marketing for this game or the way that they've presented this, where they really want to focus on the open world, like in between these dungeons and like the motorcycle and whatnot. But every time we've seen that so far, the performance hasn't been good. And that element was conspicuously absent from the preview, which just makes me worried that's still going to be a problem. And it probably won't be an issue for me, at least. But on consoles, I don't know. I don't know.
You also had a chance to review, I'm just trying to think of here, like what things we want to kind of cap off for 2025 going into 2026. A late 2025 release, of course, was the Mega Dimension DLC for Pokemon Legends.
Which is not very good.
I barely started it. I watched my brother actually play a little bit of it over the break, and when you're playing it versus when you're watching it, it's not quite the same experience. But yeah, what are your full thoughts on that DLC? Because it kind of came out really quickly, like within like a few months of the game's release. I was surprised to see it so quick, so fast compared to the base
game. It was like a month later. It's pretty annoying, actually, that they did like a month later $20 DLC for Donkey Kong, and then they did like a $30 DLC for Pokemon.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things where I think if the DLC had come out later than it did, I might have felt a little bit differently about it. But I'll fully admit that as much as I did enjoy the base game, I feel like by the time I was done with the post-game stuff for the base game, I was starting to get burnt out. And even if it wasn't for that, like the DLC really kind of, what's the best way of putting this? I think that Mega Dimensions, the cracks in Z to A's gameplay loop for the post-game stuff were already there and visible, but Mega Dimension basically takes those cracks and like magnifies them to an absurd degree, especially the further into the DLC you get. Everything that you do in the DLC past the credits roll is quite frankly miserable. And the fact that if in order to get specific Pokemon, it's through special scans, which requires you to just spam these rifts so many times, and you don't have any control over what you can get, and these special scans can be battle zones, which means they don't even get you any new Pokemon. It's just, it's not fun. It's not fun. I think that there's elements of the DLC that are nice, but actively and genuinely, Zeta A was going to be on my top 10, like, branching path, but that DLC soured my mood on the whole experience to the point where it's like, I'll put it in, like, a runner-up, because it just... You can say, well, you can just skip the DLC, but I didn't. I played the DLC, and as a result, it's like, oh, I think I like this game measurably less than before I played the DLC, and that never feels good.
Meanwhile, I kind of have that DLC listed on my backlog. Like, I want to play it to experience it, but I'm like, ugh. Like, we'll see. And it does make me wonder, like, what the Pokemon Company's big release for this year is going to be. Because we really, do we know? Do we have any inkling?
Probably Gen 10. Like, that. Really? That's the easy assumption. Because part of the reason why the DLC came out so soon after the game's launch is that people know from leaks that originally Zeta A was supposed to come out earlier in 2025, and the DLC was always meant to be late 2025, so there would have been a larger gap between the base game and the DLC if things had gone to plan.
And Arceus never got DLC, right?
No.
Yeah, so Scarlet and Violet did, because they got the, what'd they call it?
They
went to, like, Blueberry Academy or whatever it was.
There was that in the Kitakami DLC, so there was both those things. And I guess the last thing I really want to talk about is I interviewed the director for the upcoming Phantom Blade Zero. I'm actually really happy with how that interview came out. Around the Game Awards, a bunch of this stuff was around the Game Awards, they were showing off the same demo build that I played at a Tokyo Game Show. They originally offered me an opportunity to play the demo. I was like, I already played this at Tokyo Game Show, and that's why I do feel like it's worth mentioning here. One of the core people that's working on the both localization but also the marketing of Phantom Blade Zero is actually an alumni of RPG Site, that would be Kazuma Hashimoto. So just putting that out there so people understand, it didn't impact anything. Well, first off, it definitely didn't impact what I thought of the game when I played it at Tokyo Game Show, because I wasn't even aware of that fact back then. I knew that Kazuma was working on some sort, like, I thought he was just consulting. I didn't think he was actively, like, so closely involved. But beyond that, didn't impact the interview. And if you haven't already read it, I would definitely say go read it. I'm very happy with how that came out.
Well, thank you, James, for going over the busy work that you've done over the last couple of weeks. And if you have to step out from this podcast and anytime soon, if we don't hear from you again, just thanks for getting back on the swing of things with us. And good luck on your Final Fantasy 14 new rating here.
I need to grab something to eat and some caffeine. Later, everyone.
Thanks.
Take care, James.
All right, Mikhail, I know that you've had a few interview opportunities over the last couple of weeks. One of the ones that I really wanted, that I thought was really cool, probably one of my favorite interviews that we've done recently, is that you and Kite, I saw that you tag teamed on an interview with Yuka Kitamura, and this was just a real fun interview that you were able to publish both in English and Japanese. So give me some of the context about how this interview came to be and what your experience was being able to talk to her and her work on games like Elden Ring and Bloodborne.
Yeah, so this was funny how this came about, because this is the second time I've interviewed her. The first time was on Touch Arcade when the site was still alive, and it was a similar thing. So I forget what I was listening to. I think I was either playing Sekiro or I was replaying Elden Ring or something. And I was like, I just can't get over the music. And I was like, can I reach out to her and can I even interview her? How would we even do it? Because, like, it would be kind of a stretch for Touch Arcade. Like, it would literally be like the Branching Path equivalent there, because while we did cover Steam Deck and, like, the games she's worked on are all there, it would just feel so out there. But I just pitched it, like, at work, and they said go for it if you can. And I reached out to her, and the second problem was, like, how do you translate, right? Because, like, I'm not relying on Google or DeepL translation for, like, publishing an interview. So Sean Musgrave from Touch Arcade, his son actually did the translation for the interview over there. And that, basically, I was still in touch with Yuka Kitamura since then, like, just on and off here and there. And then something again happened where I was either playing Shadow of the Erdtree or Night Train or something like that. And I just asked Alex, like, she's been freelance for a bit, this will be good. And I just pitched it to him and he's like, yeah, sure. And then I reached out to her. And I said the same thing, like, we'll take care of the translation. Except in this case, like, it was literally, like, it worked out super well with Kite and me double-teaming, like, tag-teaming on this one. And, yeah, like, I didn't realize until I, like, after I pitched it to Alex that this was done with Josh for Astra Libra Revision, where it was Josh and Kite doing a similar thing. And it was published in both languages as well. So I think this is the second interview on the site which went up like that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think so. So it's always, you know, really cool and really important that, you know, we try to do this as much as we can for, you know, specific cases like this. I think it's important and really, it also, you know, we gain a wider audience too with Japanese readers seeing that.
Yeah. So, basically the restriction with the interview with Yuka Kitamura is, since she's freelance, she couldn't directly comment on, like, I couldn't just ask her, oh, like, can you talk about, like, whatever, Soul of Cinder or something like that. So I had to work around this. So I had to be vague with stuff. So when I did it on Touch Arcade, like, I was talking to a friend of mine who is also a big fan of her, and, like, I was just, like, bouncing questions and ideas off him, and I was like, how do I ask her about, like, this Sekiro boss fight? And he's like, oh, just mention this instrument and mention this passage and say, how does it feel composing a song like this? And that was super funny, but it worked out. So did something similar over here, except, like, I was a bit more general, talking about, like, how she composed DLC, because she did, like, music for DLC, then for Bloodborne and stuff like that, and how it is working freelance. And the other big thing is, she did the boss theme in Absalom, which is fantastic. And I was like, how did you even get in touch with them and, like, work with them and stuff like that? So this ended up being another one of the longer interviews I've done, but I was very happy with it. And I was also very happy that there wasn't too much overlap with the one I did, I believe it was last year or, like, a year and a half ago or so. That was very happy with that, and I thought, like, that was a fantastic way to, like, end the year, like, in terms of interviews for me, because, like, I did so many that I absolutely loved this year. So yeah, that was, like, a nice way to finish that off. And yeah, like, it seems to have done really, really well in general. Like, social, I had a lot of people reach out saying they loved it and stuff, and they're like, you should do more with other composers who, like, don't talk much, like, to English speaking fans and stuff. So yeah, let's see how 2026 goes on that front. So yeah, that was the Yuka Kitamura interview.
You had a few other interview opportunities that you had. So I'll let you pick which one you want to go to next.
So let me do the Night Dive one first. So with Night Dive, it was I interviewed them already, like, after Adam spoke to them. I forgot which event it was. Was it GDC or was it something GDC. Else where... Okay, so it was GDC where he spoke to Larry and Stephen, I believe, about System Shock 2 when it was being remastered. So I did one over there where I was just talking to them about System Shock 2 and other stuff. But when they announced System Shock Remake for Switch 1 and Switch 2, I was like, yep, now is a good time to do it again. Except this time they were also able to get Justin Kahn, who's, like, actually doing, like, heading the remake project for Night Dive with System Shock, and just in general, like, heading the remake team. So usually when I do these, like, video call or call interviews, I get, like, 30 minutes tops with like a specific person, like a dev or a publisher or something. With this, I had, like, free reign to ask them stuff for, like, 1 hour. So it was, like, massively long, and I had to, like, cut stuff out and stuff. But yeah, this is the only interview in the world which has Jazz Jackrabbit and Xenogears mentioned, and Tim Hortons, actually. So yeah, this was really insightful to find out, like, just how they approached the project, like, the struggles they had, how they considered taking System Shock Remake to Unreal Engine 5 because it was built on Unreal Engine 4, porting to the Switch. And it's unfortunate what happened, because, like, it was coming in pretty hot and they were working on the game, and I interviewed them before I had the game for review, and they had said that they had it running up at like 1080, 60 and stuff, but like the game which released was without the day one patch and it was abysmal on Switch too. So like still some room for improvement and stuff with it, but I'm not happy with the state of the game and like just some of the bugs I've run into and crashes and stuff. So hopefully whatever certification delay or just the patch they couldn't get out on time finally makes it out when it does. Because I enjoyed the remake a lot. Like, I was replaying it on PS5 before interviewing them. It's really, really good. So I was happy to be able to talk to them. And while I did focus on System Shock Remake, there was a ton more that I touched on, like pinball games and just what games they'd like to work on. There's this thing which I believe Alex wrote on Eurogamer when they were doing this Xbox 360 retrospective about Peter Jackson's King Kong, which is this like one of back then when apparently licensed games were better than they are now. And that's one of the games I brought up when I spoke to Night Dive also. And I was like, is this something you want to do? And one of the advantages of having an in-person or like on-call interview directly is you can just say whatever you want and you get a reaction to some degree. So like bringing up games like this and Condemned Origins and all these obscure titles, which would be perfect for them to bring up, is just funny when you bring these up and they just smile and, you know, they can't say anything if they're working on it or not. So it was interesting hearing their perspective on some of these titles and what they would accomplish bringing them over. Like why they would focus on the PS2 version instead of the 360 version for this and stuff like that. So if you care about Night Dive and like remasters and stuff, I recommend reading that. And the third interview I did, not December, although I mean I did do it in December, but got the responses back too late into the month, so I thought I'd start 2026 with it, is when I was obsessed with 100 Line and I was like playing it nonstop, I decided I wanted to interview Kodaka-san, and I was like, let's see if it's possible, and it was possible. So I was able to send over some questions. Usually, you know, we're told you can send over like 5 or 10 questions and we'll take care of everything else, we'll get them translated and answered. In this case, I wasn't given a limit on how many questions I could send over, so I think I sent like 35 questions. I didn't get all of them answered, obviously, but I got most of the important ones answered. So I was very happy with how this one turned out, because he was pretty candid talking about some of the challenges they ran into, the help they received from Aniplex and Xseed. And, you know, usually when you ask about potential ports to other platforms, it's just like, oh, there are no plans right now or something. And it's just straight up, yes, we want to do a Switch 2 upgrade for it, and no, we are not currently doing anything for PS5 and Xbox for this. And beyond that, there's like Danganronpa itself is like a very important game for me and like my career writing about games, because back when it came out on Vita, I had an opportunity to either cover Tukiden Kiwami or Danganronpa Trigger Happy Havoc back then. I had no idea about either of these franchises at all, and I decided to pick Danganronpa, and I just like wonder how life would be different if I had played Tukiden back then and like never touched Danganronpa. So because of that, like, it's always been with me. So I was like, you know, I need to ask him about his favorite characters, what my favorite characters are, whether he'd like, you know, do crossovers, bring Darumi Amemiya, who's my favorite character in 100 Line, what she'd do in Danganronpa, because she keeps bringing up, like, you know, the killing game trope in 100 Line as a joke and like just to play with player expectations. So it was fun hearing that and what he wants to do for DLC. And the funniest thing about this interview is I always ask about coffee at the end, but because I was interviewing him and I was also going to interview Uchikoshi-san about something else, which will go up on the site later in the year, I just decided to ask the PR, like, you know, if you're asking both of them this specific question, can you also ask about my coffee question? And the response which Uchikoshi-san gave was like, it's insane, like it's blew up on social and stuff like that. Let me just quote it because I keep forgetting the exact wording and it's worth reading. So Kodaka said, I loved iced coffee even in winter. If I want to warm up, I drink hot coffee. Uchiko, she said, damn it, why can't we get a lead on the suspect? I grumble, then chug a paper cup of black coffee, mash the cup flat out like a UFO shot down on Roswell, and chuck it into the trash with the grace of a toddler throwing a tantrum. That hard-boiled detective act is exactly how I like to drink my coffee. This is like the best response I've gotten to this question so far. So I was very happy with that.
I honestly do just love the coffee question. Just a way to kind of like bring levity to the end of the interview and kind of tie them all together and see how people decide to answer it in different clever ways. And I do kind of also like to talk about going back to the Night Dive interview, talking about like, you know, just the act of remastering games or making games, you know, revitalizing them, bringing them to a new audience. We kind of talked about that similarly, not Night Dive, but GOG when they redid Alpha Protocol. And there was like, why remake this game? Why remake a poorly received, critically panned game like this? And just talking about Peter Jackson, King Kong game or other games like that. Just talking about, you know, the whole side of game development in terms of, you know, preservation, bringing games forward, legacy, you know, IPs changing publishers' hands, all those sorts of things. There's so many different little rabbit holes that you can dive into about keeping these, you know, legacy titles alive and brought forward to new audiences.
Yeah, that, so real they cool actually just, did this just, with... Sorry to interrupt. They like, you know, this Peter Jackson's King Kong is stuff which most people would probably just write off as licensed nonsense or stuff like that. But they've even done this with other games like Killing Time Resurrected and this game called PO like /ED Definitive Edition, which these are games which I had never heard of, and they remastered them and they gave them the whole Night Dive treatment where you have like playable on all consoles, crossplay, like high resolution, high frame rate support, controller support. And these are games which aren't really considered amazing or anything, but they literally just did it because they could get the license and they wanted to preserve it. So that's something I really appreciate. It's like when GOG does stuff like Breath of Fire 4, or like they bring these random games and they make them playable on like modern PCs and stuff. I just like supporting that, even if there's a chance I don't end up liking or playing the game. It's like, I feel like these are causes worth supporting. So
I'm looking back at our features for the last couple months, and I think that covers all of the big ones. If there's any others, we'll have some time over the January timeframe to kind of ramp back up into form, so to speak, and touch on other reviews, articles, previews, op-eds that go up on the site. As we're recording this week, we're in an interesting spot here where just a couple days ago, the embargo has released for the worldwide release of Legends of Heroes Trails Beyond the Horizon, but the game doesn't actually launch until about a little less than a week from now. So by next week's episode of the podcast, Trails Beyond the Horizon will be fully released for, you know, English audiences. The demo is out now. I know I've played through the English demo. We've had, of course, others that play through the game when it originally released in Japan. But so maybe we'll kind of talk full context-free for, or it's not context-free, full discussion on Trails Beyond the Horizon for next week, though we do have a lot of the articles up on the site already. We have Scott's review, and then we have Mikhail, a couple features from you talking about the PC port and a few other different platform comparisons. But maybe we'll go into next week so that we can discuss it more openly in terms of the game is available to play for both us and, you know, the audience. I think with that, we're ready to kind of start to catch up on news. Please stop me if there's anyone else that has any other topics they want to touch on before we go into that, because we'll go into what was announced during the Game Awards, which is always kind of a big topic for us in terms of new RPG or RPG related announcements. So in no particular order here, the one that I decided to highlight here first is the big announcement from Larian Studios at the Game Awards. Ahead of the actual event, there was a lot of teasing from Jeff Keighley about, you know, a mysterious kind of piece of art about what game it was supposed to be teasing. What did it come from? People had different guesses about what this was. Turns out what Larian Studios announced is a new game, Divinity, in their IP, their Divinity series. So obviously the Divinity series has been under Larian's, you know, under their umbrella for a long time. It's an IP they fully own. Divine Divinity, Beyond Divinity, Divinity Original Sin 1 and 2. New title, just going back to Divinity, announced with a new CG trailer at the Game Awards. And then since then, that was about a month ago, we've gotten a little bit of different context about what this game is. Sven Vink did recently hold an AMA up on Reddit about Baldur's Gate 3, about Divinity, about Gen AI, about a lot of things. So there's a lot we could go into here as we talk about this release here. What did we think about the Divinity CG trailer shown at the Game Awards?
It was kind of gross.
Yeah, I was actually going to say, like, I wasn't going to tee it up, but it didn't hold back in terms of being a bit unsettling.
So when this trailer first started airing, I know we were expecting a Diablo expansion trailer, which we actually did get later in the Game Awards. So I was like, oh, this must be Diablo, because, you know, it was like some person on some sort of like pyre, almost like crucified, turning into like a big, like kind of like melting and turning into a demon. And it was like, oh, this is definitely Diablo. Like, nope, I was wrong. It was not Diablo. It was Divinity. And also there's like lizards and like an orgy. It was a trailer. A lot happening.
I don't mind that, like, you know, it was designed the way it was. Like, it's totally fine. I was kind of, I guess, more thrown off, like, oh, they allow that, you know, sort of trailer on the big stage like that. I thought there were restrictions around that. I guess not. And not to say, like, it should be banned. Like, no, like, I'm all for it. It's just, you know, it's one of those, it's like, hopefully they leave, you know, other developers that same leeway if they're willing to get, you know, this sort of game that leeway as well, which I imagine they won't. I just think about that a lot, of like what developers kind of have, like, the mandate of heaven in that regard and what developers don't.
Yeah, there was some discussion on, like, Horses, the indie game, getting banned from Steam, and then now here's this trailer for a Larian game, which will definitely be on Steam, showing, you know, people having orgies, and there's, like, you know, there's people pointed out, like, there's children in these scenes also, like, yeah, right there, mm-hmm, and somewhere, you know, things like that. Yes. Like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, like, the biggest, like, lore authority on Divinity. I've only played Original Sin 1 and 2, but, like, for whatever, like, this is not what I associate with it. Not saying that it is or isn't or right or wrong, but, like, when I played Divinity Original Sin 1 and 2, the thing that kind of stuck with me is how, like, lighthearted they are at, you know, in parallel with being, you know, I guess, like, high fantasy games. Like, the Larian logo famously has, like, a plunger dart landing on that character's face. Like, it's supposed to be silly and kind of quirky. And there's this imp named, I think, like, Zigzax or whatever. And he has a very, like, particular humorous way of speaking. And you're in that town of Sicile, I believe, at the beginning of Original Sin 1. And there's, like, goofy merchants barking around saying, like, come get your sheep's cheese and your tomatoes. And it's, and then, like, here's this game that's really, like, taking itself, at least based on the vibes from this trailer, like, seriously, which is a similar tack that they took in Baldur's Gate 3 with its original, like, CG trailers of the mind flayers taking over, you know, characters' bodies and minds and them becoming transformed in a matter of moments. So this isn't new for Larian, and I'm not saying therefore this game is always never going to have a silly moment in it, but just that's how they decided to, like, first showcase the game is interesting. I'm not saying it's good or bad, I don't know yet, but it's interesting that that's the tack that they took. So I'm looking at some of the other different, like, Larian related news that we've had since then. We've talked about Divinity, we talked about Baldur's Gate. Some of these we got a little bit of small amount of detail from a recent Reddit AMA. They're interested in potentially looking at bringing Divinity to Switch 2. They've interestingly said that they also were interested in potentially scoping what it could take to take Baldur's Gate 3 to Switch 2, but Sven very candidly stated that it wasn't their decision to make. Where we don't know explicitly, but reading between the lines, looking at previous comments, the relationship between Larian Studios and Hasbro / Wizards of the Coast, who own the Baldur's Gate IP, which is in a much different standing from the Divinity IP, which they own themselves. So in one situation, they're very open and allowed to make decisions fully upon themselves, where in Baldur's Gate 3's case, they don't have quite the same leverage. So it's interesting to see that they're not going to follow up on Baldur's Gate. They're going back to Divinity, which is not a move I don't think anyone besmirches, because Divinity Original Sin 1 and 2 are well-regarded. So But you kind of read, say, oh, I can understand why they're going back to Divinity after the success of Baldur's Gate 3. And now that they have a little bit more prestige, maybe a little bit more backing, their studio has grown a lot, what they're able to do in their IP at that sense. Go ahead, Mikhail.
Yeah, like, I think everyone expected them to do BG4 because of how much BG3 sold, but they probably...
I'm not sure about expected, but we thought that they could. They easily could, but I don't know if, like, expected, but it's interesting to see that now it's off the table, seemingly.
I think expected around BG3's launch would make sense, but everything that's been, like, rumored or, like, just, you know, obviously this is all speculation, but everything that's happened since then paints a picture that probably, like, they wanted to go their separate ways. Like, if I had to speculate, I think I read this report that Wizards of the Coast earned like $90 million from the license or whatever, and this is a game which Larian published, like, on their own. They developed, they said they funded it also, apparently. So this is basically their game, and they've obviously made more than that from it. So maybe Wizards of the Coast wanted more or whatever. Again, speculation, but they probably couldn't agree to terms for BG4 if they wanted to do that. Or maybe they just wanted to, like, get back to doing Divinity, like you said, with more prestige and stuff. But I did find it interesting that, like, he straight up just said that we'd love to have brought it to Switch 2, but it's not our decision to make, which, like, you usually wouldn't, you just leave it up to, you know, just say that, oh, it would be great to have it there or something, but just straight up, like, saying that kind of just tells me that they don't want to work with Wizards of the Coast anymore. Again, speculation, but that's how I read it.
Yeah, we will never really know unless in the future we get, like, a tell-all memoir or a biography or something. But what I always go back to is, I forget if it was a Game Awards speech or some other platform, but when Sven went to accept either the Game Award or reflect back on it, he implied that the people that were in place when the agreement was first made to work on Baldur's Gate 3 were no longer there. So, like, people rotated in or out of positions, and then by the time everything was said and done, so many things had changed from 2019 when it was first announced. It just seems like, you know, the people at Hasbro potentially, or Wizards of the Coast, that were there when everything was started are no longer there. So you can kind of see why, or that kind of colors how things have changed
in
the 6 years of development and release. Go ahead, Josh.
I mean, speaking of coloring how things have changed, I think it's important to even point out the context of why this Reddit AMA even began for Divinity.
Oh, yep, go ahead.
Like, you know, the follow-up from this reveal from the Game Awards was, hey, does Ven kind of openly admitted that they were messing around with generative AI, especially the concept art phase of this, for this game. Not necessarily implementing generative AI directly into the game, but using generative AI for concept artists to, like, kind of get into, like, a, like, ideas framework. Like, you know, like, usually, like, traditionally when concept artists would use, like, let's say, like, you know, stock photos, Google images for, like, references to kind of get a feel of, like, what they want, you know, the like, the atmosphere, the game world, like, what kind of, just getting ideas. Like, they were messing around with generative AI in that respect, and obviously, you know, for understandably, that did not land well with the public. And personally, it doesn't land well with me either. I don't like that part of that whole thing. So this kind of really blew up, obviously, in social media and a lot of online spaces, to the point that, like, the whole reason that the Reddit AMA happened for Larian Studios about Divinity was, hey, we want to be open with the community and try to have a discussion about it, so we'll hold this Reddit AMA about it. And so, like, you know, like, a lot of the Sven, and I believe the lead writer on Divinity, I forgot their name off the top of my head, but they both basically confirmed they're not going to directly have generative AI in Divinity, and the lead writer was very open in saying, I'm not using generative AI at all for any part of Divinity. Was very much against, like, implementing generative AI in the writing process, at least what they're up in charge of. They're still pretty a little, like, in my opinion, still being shady on, like, what else they're using generative AI for. Like, even though Divinity itself won't have generative AI directly in the game, I think it's still around the borderline edges that they're, like, you know, may turn to generative AI for, you know, other indirect parts of the game, whether it's like conjuring up ideas, and they didn't say this directly in the AMA, but you know, it could also be like how Clair Obscur may implement it, where it might be like, you know, prototype textures that will get
placeholders,
you know, patched out. Yeah, placeholders. Like, so it's still, you know, no one's really satisfied with their answer. I mean, obviously some people will buy it and be like, okay, well, this is maybe the right way to do it, which is my opinion. There's no really quote unquote right way to do when you're talking about generative AI in that respect, because I think the big thing that like Sven was trying to convey to the public was like, if we use generative AI, it'll be like our own model trained up on only our own works, which opens up a can of worms, because one, as many people have already pointed out, much more intelligent people than me who are more familiar with this stuff, that like, hey, to even get something like workable with generative AI with a framework model, you would need more than millions of like references. You would need like billions, and that and that's what makes generative AI competent, is by having a very, 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 very large reference framework, way more than your in like studio in isolation will have to make something workable and even acceptable. So that's feasibly not even possible, even by like the framework of like all the studio's previous output, if you're just quote unquote doing it on your own model, making, you know, having generative AI trained on your own model, which you know, not feasible by the scope of like getting something acceptable. And two, when you're inherently employing generative AI with only your studio's own model, and I agree with people on this, like the nature of like working for companies is come and go. There are some people like contractors who are only on there for a limited amount of time, like say a 6-month contract. So whatever they produce for the company in that 6-month framework and are then let go because that's the rules of their contract, let's say, that hypothetical generative AI model is still using their work as part of that internal model then. And let's say it's a contract work for 6 months, for instance, let's say, does the artist have any say in consenting to that or not? Or mm-hmm. is it just like all baked in the contract, like, no, everything that you produce is ours and we can do whatever the fuck we want with it, and we can train it on our own internal model, let's say. So thanks for all you've done. We'll be taking what you've done and training our model, but incorporating your work into it, which is, you know, opens up a lot of can of worms in that respect too. So inherently, you know, there's no, I would say, quote unquote, right or ethical way to employ it, from my perspective. Let's say, it is strictly for generative AI. It's not like for other types of AI, like maybe programming and like, you know, code and stuff like that. Like, obviously I'm not like an expert on it. I don't know of like what other types of AI, especially the modern understanding of AI, actually do genuinely benefit people and help assist them in like in a way that's like, you know, it actually helps their day to day in a positive way. But I am firmly against the employment of generative AI because it's inherently a flawed framework from the get-go, you know, just foundationally for me. That's
yeah,
and kind of providing context around it.
And I know for me, I'm still kind of determining, learning enough about it so that I kind of know, you know, where are those lines drawn, and they're going to be drawn for different people, in different places. And you mentioned like if someone's using an AI tool to help develop code instead of going to Stack Overflow, is that fine or is it not? And maybe it depends on what they're doing or what they get out of it or what ends up in the final product, versus developing concept art, versus placeholders, versus final assets, versus it's complicated. And but it, based on Sven's initial comments and the comments that came out of the AMA, it just seems like, you know, AI is being used at Larian Studios. To what degree, we don't know the details. It sounds like they're still determining that themselves. Other studios have already commented that they've used AI and won't again. A Clair Obscur producer basically said, yeah, we did, but it wasn't very helpful, so we're not going to use it again. Other studios like Hooded Horses, I believe, the publisher of Manor Lords, have very declaratively said, like, we are not using AI at all, 100%. Like, they've had a very firm stance saying that they're not going to. Other producers like at Warhorse have said, you know, AI is inevitable. So other studios, Cygames, have opened up an AI studio. Level 5 have mentioned that they want to figure out how they can best leverage AI to, you know, make the best games they can. So every studio kind of has a slightly different posture on where they stand now, where they plan to stand. And it's just something that it's going to be a continuous topic throughout the whole year. Yeah. So
yes,
so we'll try to be on this podcast as open as possible. But Larian Studios, to some level, is using AI. It's going to be used in the development of their game Divinity. So that seems to be where we're at for that game. I guess the only other thing we haven't talked about Divinity is that, Adam, remind me if I'm wrong, they have mentioned that they're planning to do an early access period for it, which is not unusual because Divinity 1, 2, and Baldur's Gate 3 all did that as well, so that is not a new hat for them. And then I think we're gonna. One other thing I do also remember is that I guess some things were spiked in terms of like people downloading older Divinity games, you know, in kind of like preparation for it. And I've never played like Divine Divinity or Beyond Divinity or Divinity Dragon Commander, so I'm like, all right, maybe I can squeeze those in to see like, you know, where Larian came from before, you know, original Sin 1 and 2 and Baldur's Gate 3 in preparation for their newest title.
That'd be an interesting project. Huh.
Mm-hmm. Here's one that I cannot speak to very, very well, but I know other people, I know James has, I believe other people have as well. A new project coming out of Remedy Entertainment. This was a big surprise to me, especially when I read it and watched you cover it, Josh. They announced a game called Control Resonant. And we do not cover a lot of Remedy games here on RPG Site because they're RPG adjacent at best. But Control Resonant, we're covering for a deliberate reason because they're saying that they are calling this an open-ended action-adventure RPG. Remedy Entertainment is deliberately placing Control Resonant in that RPG space. So talk about what they showed here with Control Resonant. And I presume you've played Control.
I enjoyed it a lot. That was a really cool game. And in some respects, you know, some people can argue that like Control is sort of like RPG because of its progression systems. I wouldn't, you know, it kind of toes that line, right? But yeah, Control Resonant is the direct sequel of Control, and this time you're in control of Dylan Faden. That's the younger brother of the previous main character, Jesse Faden. And the trailer, the debut trailer for this is kind of way different than how Control does it, because Control, Jesse uses a lot of guns and has like telekinetic powers to shift around the environment, and it was in this bureau environment that for the entire game. So in Control Resonant, Dylan has this shape-shifting weapon that turns into like different melee weapons. So like you see like sort of like twin poles, the sickle, and sort of like this club weapon that as you're getting into an encounter, I don't even know what the base weapon is and why it shape shifts, but throughout the trailer you see this weapon sort of turn into other weapons, and so it's a much more melee combat, almost combo-esque a game. I'm kind of interested to see like what direct gameplay will look like, if this will maybe resemble some sort of like a Devil May Cry-esque action game in that regard. And it's in an open outside environment now. You're not in that, I forget what it's called, like the oldest house or something like that in the first game. So it's not indoors. You're very much outdoors investigating these supernatural phenomenon throughout Manhattan. So I believe like the store pages are up now if people wanted to like see it and wishlist it and all sorts of stuff. But I'm very much looking forward to this. I mean, Remedy is pretty consistent with the quality of their games outside of like FBC Firebreak, which is not a great, it was a big misstep because of their first, you know, dipping their toes into the live service sector, and, you know, had to learned a lot of harsh lessons and seeing, you know, what the future of that game might hold. But in terms of outside of that, like, I think Alan Wake 2, Control, the first Alan Wake. Like, Remedy is pretty damn consistent in that regard. I'm very much looking forward to Control Resonant. We'll probably do a replay of Control. Maybe I'll play the Alan Wake 2. I don't know. But definitely a replay of Control. I'm excited for this.
Another announcement from the Game Awards was, I believe this is the debut project from Negoshi Studio, which is spun off from the former head of RGG Studio at Sega, of course. So this is a new game called Gang of Dragon, which when I saw this, I think a lot of people had a very similar kind of first immediate response for what they thought of when they thought of Gang of Dragon. Is that it looked kind of familiar. So this is a game with action adventure gameplay involving takes place in the Kabukicho. Thank you. Yeah. Which is the inspiration behind the RGG Studios' Kamurocho, so the Red Light District in Tokyo, Japan. And this game looks like it is very clearly inspired by, you know, Like a Dragon series of games. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, you know what they say, you know, the more things change, the more things stay the same. And Negoshi's like, you know what, I can make any game I want now after, you know, leaving RGG Studio. I can make it anywhere I want. I can, like, you know, put this game environment anywhere else. And he lands himself back to, you know, where he began, you know. Well, he began kind of like in Super Monkey Ball. But, you know, first Yakuza, still in Kabukicho. Can't seem to, you know, separate himself away from it. But it's cool because they're using a live action star, a South Korean character in Shin Ji-song, I believe his name is. And he's very, very, very popular these days, especially in Korean cinema. Has a very large, bulky build, kind of just built like a tank, and you know they really. I got the wrong character. I believe as Mikhail pointed out in our chat, Ma Dong Seok. Sorry if I mispronounce. I'm not really good with Korean names. And he, unlike the Yakuza games, occasionally in the Yakuza game you do have a firearm. In this one, you seem to have like a lot of like very heavy weapons. Like one of the screenshots is like an entire assault rifle, a flamethrower, throwing grenades, and it has a fascination with like cars as well. So you have this whole car mechanic where you spend money to customize them, different parts, different paint, and I really wonder how much of the car mechanic will play out in Gang of Dragon. So this is a really, you know, interesting game to follow with where Ma Dong Seok is playing this in-game character Shin Ji-song in this game. And it's a third-person action game. Very, very cool to see. I hope that Negoshi Studio, you know, is able to continue doing what it's doing after this project, because I think the main worry about this is maybe they'll suffer the same fate as the studio that worked on Visions of Mana, which unfortunately, you know, after that game shipped under NetEase, similar arrangement.
Yeah, these are both under NetEase.
Yeah, similar arrangement, but unfortunately, you know, Visions of Mana, even like just maybe a day or two after it came out, like that whole studio was dissolved and disbanded after its release, which was really tragic. Luckily, some of the staff from there was able to land on their feet, I believe, under Square.
So, yeah. They grabbed a lot of the talent. I don't know how much, but at least some of the key contributors.
Yeah. So hopefully Negoshi Studio is able to not suffer the same fate and, you know, stay together and continue making, like, you know, cool games even after Gang of Dragon. I'm interested. Very, very curious.
Yeah, I don't think anyone should be faulted for saying, like, this looks like Yakuza, because it clearly does. Like, we would be lying to ourselves to, like, not make that comparison. But, you know, hopefully we'll see, as, you know, we don't have a release window for this yet. It's probably still a bit a ways off, but seeing what they have in store to, like, differentiate it, you know, stand on its own, what it does same, what it does differently, better, worse than the series that inspired it. So, because of course, you know, Nagoshi spent a long time at Sega at RGG Studio. So, we'll keep tabs on it and, you know, see what we have going forward. The last major game announcement I have listed here, there were others. I put in just in our little outline here the key highlights, though I did not list absolutely everything. So if anyone participating in the podcast has something that was brought up that I didn't put here as we go through and we wrap up the news here, feel free to bring that up. This one is a new game in the Star Wars project, in the Star Wars universe, a new Star Wars project, Star Wars Fate of the Old Republic, very clearly borrowing a name from the popular RPG series Knights of the Old Republic, or the MMO The Old Republic, with a lot of the same talent, like Casey Hudson, who directed Knights of the Old Republic, who also was at BioWare when they were making the Mass Effect trilogy, got a new CG trailer for this. This game seems like it is very, very far out. Adam, I know you had a few insights on what they showed for Fate of the Old Republic and why some, you know, certain people like Jason Schreier said you might not see this prior to 2030. Like, this game is a ways out. There was some pushback on that, but Adam, what do you think about this?
Yeah, so first of all, I was amused at how fast, and this is kind of a mild amusement, but how fast, as soon as they announced Fate of the Old Republic, people were like, FOTOR, as a kind of acronym nickname. Yep. Just because it's a funny, it's not a word, but it's kind of a funny word if you say it that way. It's FOTOR. Yep. But yeah, so also it's kind of funny, they introduced Casey Hudson as like the director of the Mass Effect trilogy, and it's like, well, he was also the original director of Anthem. You gotta remember that too. But yeah, so maybe some background to this. So Casey Hudson was working at his studio called Human Origin, which was working on a AAA sci-fi game, and I'm trying to remember who was that that was under, but that studio was just closed. Like, suddenly, like, before getting anything off the ground. And that wasn't that long ago. That was, like, at the end of 2024. So, my point is Casey Hudson was not working on Fate of the Old Republic in 2024. He was working on something else that would no longer exist. And now, about a year later, he announces this game. So, within the calendar year of 2025, this studio was founded, and this is their first project. What's the studio's name?
You have listed on the site Arcanaut.
Yeah, I'm not sure you pronounce it, but this is a new studio. And so it inevitably has to be like early on. This isn't something that's been in the works for years because the timelines don't line up, right? So people quickly deduced that this kind of announcement trailer that was shown at the Game Awards is also largely like a recruitment trailer. Basically, hey, I want to make this game. Here is a trailer that's almost like a concept. Like, this is just ideas that we want to do. We want to make a big budget, you know, follow up to a very well beloved Star Wars RPG. It's got a similar name and everything. Come work with us to make that. So that basically was Jason Trier's point. Like, this game is early and it's probably going to take several years for it to be like tangible. So.
And there was some pushback. I forget who it was from, but they said, like, no, you're going to see this before 2030. But
I think Casey Hudson himself basically said, I'm not getting any younger, which, you know, sure, he's probably hoping it's out sooner than later, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah. But is that Knights of the Republic remake still being worked on?
Like, I believe,
what's the status of that?
I believe that one. So it was announced by Aspyr. And then they basically said they're no longer working on it. And Jason Schreier, again, at Bloomberg, reported that that project went to Saber Interactive and it's in development there. But that was never official. And if it's still there, there's been no word of it. So, like, maybe they're still working on it. Maybe they're not. Because that was never official. So who knows? Mm.
The perfect, it'll come out like a year before Fate of the Old Republic, so 2028, 2029, the perfect, you know, thing to get into before the spiritual sequel, successor to KOTOR.
I love watching trailers of games that are announced way too far ahead.
like FF7 remake, the first time they showed it off.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's always a little bit of different context between, like, Because you might be saying, like, we might be saying FOTOR and Divinity at around the same time, but, like, a new studio stood up within a year of the announcement versus a studio that's been in the game a long time. Like, there is a little bit of context behind whenever we see, like, this super early trailer. Because I've always been on board with, like, CG trailers for announcements are fine, but, like, if they show up next year with another CG trailer, that's when I'm kind of like, all right, let's just let it cook for a bit and then show us, you know, once the game starts to materialize. Both before we proceed, Mikhail did have to step out. You know, time zones, it's the middle of the night for him. So obviously, thank you to Mikhail when he listens back to this for all of the different work that he did with the interviews and articles from over the holiday break. One other game announcement. This one's real quick. It was basically all but announced prior to mid-December. But Trails in the Sky, sorry. Tickle my throat. Trails in the Sky, second chapter. We knew this was coming based on the movie at the end of the first chapter, but officially announced to release in fall 2026. We got the key art for it and all of that for later this year.
Yeah, I think the most significant thing about this reveal when the store pages went up, especially on Steam, is like they're finally getting like a unified like Steam SKU release. So like traditionally with Trails games recently, there's always a divide between like the Chinese and Korea region releases and like the international releases between Clouded Leopard Entertainment and then obviously in Nice, America, and all that sort of stuff. So you always had like, for example, like the first chapter remake, you have like Sora no Kiseki first chapter and then Trails in the Sky first chapter or the first or whatever. Like they're their own separate releases. Even like East 10 and then East 10 for China and Korea, like even though there's identical titles, they have separate Steam store pages releases, which is really annoying.
Those ones are even more confusing because it's not even like a different title name. It's literally, if you look up East Nordics or Monstrum Nox on Steam, you'll see it twice.
Yeah, and then it's you always have to look at like the publisher, make sure you're getting like, you know, the actual proper region title for what you're getting on them. But this one, with Trails in the Sky second chapter, they finally, at long last, united them because it's simultaneous worldwide release. So now Falcom, Clouded Leopard Entertainment, and Nice America are like actually all collaborating with one another together, unified to make one Steam page release. So there's no like any confusion whatsoever on like what game you're getting and for what region. It's like, no, it's all the same goddamn region. Don't worry about it now. It's all reunified. So that was like the biggest thing for people who pay attention to that sort of stuff. It's like, oh, thank God they're finally doing this, because that was really annoying in prior years, like having this divide different store pages and so forth.
Imagine buying a wrong version. They had to deal with hassles and refunds.
Yeah, it's annoying.
Looking back at some other announcements from December and January, obviously one of the big releases coming out in February is Dragon Quest VII Reimagined. They did also announce a pretty lengthy demo for that game. There's demos that were announced in the last month for both Beyond the Horizon's English version and coming out, of course, in just a week. And then Dragon Quest VII Reimagined coming out in February, with both of them will carry over through to their respective launches. So I know personally I've downloaded both demos, so I'm trying to get as much of a head start as possible on those because I don't have early access. But yeah, there's a Dragon Quest VII Reimagined demo available now, and Square Enix for that game have also revealed like the opening movie and all that other stuff.
I hear it's a pretty lengthy demo, like around maybe like 3 to 4 hours worth of game there. So not maybe
didn't
I'll play
cut
that
out like one. Didn't it cut out like one of the first dungeons? Like I remember my friends already complaining to me. It's like, oh man, it took like 10 hours to get through this, and they already cut it down to one.
It's one of those things you have to kind of. It's that there's a reason that it's called Reimagined in the title. You just have to accept, I guess, that like, you know, it's gonna be different from both of the prior releases, both the original version and already the 3DS remake version. I imagine it's gonna be considerably different.
Yeah. So. I played the demo. The demo, it kind of ends where you might expect it to end. Have you played Dragon Quest or Dragon Warrior 7 before? So it includes the entire first scenario, which is always the same. In the original Dragon Warrior 7, it was called Rexwood. In the 3DS version and in the new version, it's called Bailey Malloy. Totally different town name, but same place. It's the scenario with the tower and the golem in the tower. and things like that. So it's like the whole first scenario that you do, that's in the demo. But yeah, the dungeon that Chao is referring to, I just played the PS1 version, so this is fresh in my mind. When you go to the what's called the Shrine of... what is it called? They keep changing the names on these things. When you go to the original shrine where all the warp tiles are, in the original release, it's actually like a full dungeon. There's no like battles in it, but there's a lot of like puzzles to get through to actually get to the where you use the tablets and the pedestals. But that's all been taken out. You go to the shrine and you're the first room you're in, bam, they're the tablets right there. That's just one example of one way they're streamlined.
Jeez.
So
crazy. Yeah.
Shrine of Mysteries is what it's called in this version. I forget what it's called in older versions. It's where the pedestals are.
So how long does it take to get to the first battle now?
They added... So, historically, the first battle in Dragon Quest VII is after you warp for the first time to Rexwood, or Bailey Malloy, Maribel runs into slimes and is like, ew, what are these things? And then you fight slimes, and that's like your first battle finally after like 2 hours. Here, they actually added a battle when you're with Kiefer, as you're like trying to figure out how to even open the shrine, because that's like the first part of the game is you were kind of palling around with him trying to figure out how to get to the shrine, because he's trying to like figure out the puzzle. And there's actually like a tutorial battle before then, which I've seen some funny responses to. Like, no, they broke the sanctity of Dragon Quest VII by adding this battle here.
I don't know. I don't think there's like any like clean cut answer what they do with this game, but. I don't know.
I mean, you know, it's like equally so. Like, you know, you see a lot of people who've never played Dragon Quest VII before. It's like, hey, I really like the demo. I really like, you know, kind of just seeing it for the first time and playing it. And it's, you know, it's gaining, you know, a lot of new players and a lot of new interest in it, which is kind of the goal of this. It's, you know.
I'm going to ask Adams one last opinion. So after playing both of the 3DS version and the PS1 version, which version do you prefer now?
Of those two?
Yes.
Probably the original, slightly. The sprites do a lot for me. I really like the sprites compared to like the 3DS models. And I don't know, I kind of just kind of steeped myself in the slower pace of the game. Reimagined, based on the demo, is definitely even more like up-paced in dialogue, in, you know, combat and things like that. But yeah, I think I slightly prefer the original. And like I said, I think the sprite style, visual style is a big reason why.
These aren't trailers, but these are like announcements or updates for existing games from December and January. This first one is one I was not expecting. Released in mid-December, a game that ended up on my top 10 list, Tainted Grail, The Fall of Avalon, the kind of indie Skyrim-like sent in a dark King Arthur-like envisioning of that Arthurian legend. It released, I believe, in May of last year. They have like a water-themed expansion that released in December called Sanctuary of Saras, S-A-R-R-A-S. So this one I was not expecting, because to me, when I played Tainted Grail Fall of Avalon, I really thought that the base game still needed quite a few layers of polish, which has been continuously updated since its release. But just, I guess, the team over at Questline and Awakened Realms had some ambitious ideas on the table. I've heard that this expansion is actually pretty good, though... I'm thinking that this will be something that I'll probably want to play at some point, because I enjoyed the base game enough, though I'm just going to give it some time to be polished up. It seems like I always run into, like, you know, these developers that are really ambitious but release games. We talked about Rogue Trader on Switch 2, not running very well from Owlcat, just allowing it to kind of, like, it's coming in hot and giving it some time to show its best foot forward when I get around to it. But Tainted Grail got an expansion in December. I'll probably play it at some point, and maybe I'll even throw up a quick review for it, depending on how I feel about it. Here is a topic that was something we talked about frequently, I think more in like 2024 era, maybe early 2025. Last year was the 25th anniversary of Final Fantasy IX, and throughout the year, in different avenues, we would see like new art shared from Square Enix, you know, official accounts. We would see like a lot of people having like memoirs or, you know, reflections or celebrations of a well-received game, a well-loved game, especially for this site, for RPG site, in our history, for Final Fantasy IX reaching its 25th year anniversary. And alongside of that, an anime project was discussed and not ever really fully revealed. We only ever saw like bits and pieces for it. that was unceremoniously seemingly dropped and, you know, no longer happening. And that was kind of a bummer. And obviously the big thing is, the game going to be remade? Is it going to be something in like the Visions of Mana? That was kind of like the scuttlebutt that it was going to be, not Visions of Mana, sorry, Trials of Mana, that it was going to be kind of at that level of a remake for the game potentially, but never announced, never materialized, never became more than, you know, suspected. It seemed like we were going to go and say, like, you know, whatever plan Square Enix had for the 25th anniversary, what we got is what we got. We got some art, we got some celebration. That's kind of all it was going to be. But it seems like reportedly in a new issue of a French magazine, Écran Total, that a new group has potentially picked up a new Final Fantasy IX animated series targeted to release in 2028. Which is, I guess, going to be something that is a kind of a successor to the story of Final Fantasy IX, following up on like Vivi and the Mages, is how I understand this the most. Have I missed any details on that, Adam? What do you know about this?
Yeah, so to be clear, it was always like a French animation, franime type project. And yeah, it was never like officially announced, but it was originally like, in like, supposed to be in like a production like conference for like animation in France like years ago, but there was never any like public like key art or anything to go on. And yeah, now it's sort of like revived, I guess, again, more in like a business side journal. So there really still hasn't been any much to go on in terms of like consumer side facing like announcement or anything. It's all just business side, you know, green lighting type, like apparently it was greenlit, then put on hiatus, and now it's just been picked up again. That's what we know, supposedly.
And also, so the listing says that this is a children's show, which I believe is in line with the original, like what we knew. So like for young kids, 13 episodes, standard runtime of like 22 or so minutes apiece. So Just to kind of have it out there, like this is not a big, long anime project for, you know, us that grew up with the game. This is just kind of for an offshoot taking place after the game for children. But it's still kind of interesting to see that it has not fully dead. It's not 6 feet under yet. So it'll be interesting to see if we see anything from this. But I won't be surprised if it's not for this year, since it is targeted at, for 2028. So might still be a few years off before we see anything from it.
Our 30th anniversary. Final Fantasy IX remake comes out in 2028. All right.
There we go. It was in the NVIDIA leak. It'll happen. It has to. No. Or you could, Final Fantasy IX, you know, Maguri mod is I've heard really good things about. Still a great game. A game that I revisited not too long ago. So we'll see what comes out of the new animation project for this, if it ends up seeing the light of day. Just cool to know that there is a pulse. And here's an interesting one, that there's a little bit of context on this that people have responded to in positive and not so positive ways. So one of the early RPG releases from last year was Avowed. This was a Obsidian Entertainment game, one of their first big releases, fully backed by the, you know, Obsidian Entertainment being obtained by under the umbrella of Microsoft. There's a lot of different holes we could go into talking about Microsoft in 2025 and into the future. There's a lot of context here. We could talk about that in a lot of different ways for a long time. This is, though, about shortly after the release of Avowed, the studio at Obsidian Entertainment showed a very general roadmap for their updates for that game. In that roadmap, they talked about updating like how many trait points you get. And the last section of that roadmap that they were planning to incorporate into Avowed was a new game plus mode and a few other things, a new weapon type, things like that. They detailed last year that update was going to be pushed into 2026. And then this week, what they've announced is that is going to be released on February 17th, bundled into a release for PlayStation 5 as a console release. So prior to that point, it was only available on Xbox hardware or PC. Now, Avowed is going to get a major update detailing New Game Plus, New Game Mode, all that sorts of things, along with releasing on PlayStation 5. Adam, thoughts on this? Sorry to just keep bouncing back to you, but I know that you mentioned before we started recording what you had seen, you know, as kind of response to this announcement for Avowed.
So I saw someone comment like, oh, so the Xbox players on this, or Steam players, were basically beta testers, and now PlayStation players get to get that feedback and update when they buy it and get a better game. And I saw some people say the same thing is going to happen with Starfield, even to maybe even a more significant extent, considering it's been 2 or 3 years since then, where Starfield 2.0 or whatever it ends up being called will release, and people expect, this isn't announced, but will expect that that will also come alongside a PlayStation 5 port. So there's sort of this, I saw Alex Donaldson, our boss, actually kind of mention on Blue Sky, like, Microsoft better be careful that they don't, this doesn't become like a pattern where people just expect, like, oh, don't buy it on Xbox, just wait, and you'll get even a better version on PlayStation later, right? So, anyways, right now we just have one data point, and that's just Avowed, coming out about a year after its original release with a big update and a new platform.
I'm pretty curious about this as someone who played through and reviewed Avowed, because even though Avowed, when I first played it, even though I was pretty completionist on it, like, I didn't reach the max level, like, because that game was, the way it was set up initially is that you were pretty resource starved in terms of, like, almost to the game's detriment in terms of, like, how much EXP was available, how many resources were available to keep your weapons up to par. You didn't have a lot of opportunity to try out different weapons or have, like, the number of trait points you had versus how many you needed to, like, make any, like, interesting builds. It was just very, very, like, almost overly constrained. I think there have already been some patches where you gain more, and I don't think they're called trait points in the game, but it has, like, a fairly, you know, contemporary skill tree where you have melee range and magic, and you put trait points into different abilities that allow you to do different things. But so they've already addressed some of that, but now that they have new game plus, now that they have some new races and a new weapon type, and they've already kind of done, like, another editing pass on just some of the fundamental RPG-ness of the game in terms of progression and resource management, it does seem like anyone who plays Avowed in 2026 starting on PlayStation is gonna get a better game than what we got on Steam or Xbox last year. And all the scuttlebutt about a Starfield next or Starfield 2, also a game that kind of landed and didn't really leave a splash. If they managed, again, we don't know anything about that, none of this is confirmed, to make, like, a better game available on PlayStation, it's just like, well, yeah, Xbox releases, unless they become, you know, completely worldwide releases from this point forward, the PlayStation version is going to end up being, like, the definitive one. It's an interesting position that
kind of weird byproduct of, like, just modern games in general, because, like, this anniversary update is still going to be available to Xbox Series X and S and PC. Yeah. But, you know, it's not like it's going to be exclusive to PS5 or anything. And this is kind of just, like, kind of like this weird, unfortunate reality where if you are interested in a game and you wait, like, 3 to 6 months after release, you will probably get a better experience than people who played it at launch, and probably at a lower price too. Because, like, you know, there'll be optimization fixes, maybe more content down the road after its release. So it's kind of like just a weird, like, I don't know, kind of a weird target of, like, this is not exclusive to, like, this game and right, it coming to PS5. Like, this is sort of a byproduct of, like, every modern release of every modern game of, like, you will probably get a better experience if you wait just a little and buy it at a lower price because they'll have some time to kind of fix the things, launch problems.
Unless the title of your game is Wu-Chang Fallen Feathers.
Yes. Well, they'll still get optimization fixes, but unfortunately they'll also get actual censorship as well.
I'm never touching that game again, sorry.
Yeah, I think the thing about Avowed and Starfield is that these were the big, like, why, yeah, you know,
right,
Xbox over the last 6 years, and I know you know this, I'm just restating,
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
sure. Xbox over the last 6 years has a lot more shortcomings than victories, I'll say very generically. And, like, Avowed and Starfield were the big, like, okay, Microsoft, show what you got. And now that those are the games, potentially, Avowed confirmed, Starfield rumored, to be in that same boat of, okay, people have waited, now I can play this really awesome Xbox game on my PlayStation. Just the connotation of that is, it's an interesting position, like you said, that they find themselves in. Talking about Avowed itself, like, I know it didn't really leave a huge splash, and I know it didn't end up on our site's top 10, and even my review for it was kind of, like, whelmed, like, it's good, but sort of thing. it's a game that has really excellent exploration, and I do think it has a really fun setting. I wish the story I latched on too strongly. If you're a gamer that's really driven by like strong, compelling narrative, I did not find that in Avowed, for better or worse. Again, that's my opinion. You might play it and love it. But I did think that it had a really fun, almost arcadey exploration feel in terms of just like environmental design. Combat, first-person combat, also, it's a really good game for showcasing like what a hybrid melee spellcaster combat in first-person could be like. So for those, I do suggest that when this game comes out on February 17th, if you have a PlayStation, to give it a try.
And also, since we're in this like sort of ballpark of like Microsoft published stuff, they're gonna have like a developer direct event fairly soon that will focus on Fable, the new Forza Horizon set in Japan, and the Beast of Reincarnation game that they showed off at their Summer Game Fest event, and that's being developed by Game Freak, so they'll have updates on both on those titles. We don't know if they're gonna have another thing, you know, at that developer direct that they often do, but
Starfield 2.
Yeah, we'll see.
Or 2.0 or whatever.
Yeah, but I'm pretty interested in like all three of these titles. Like, it's cool that like, you know, the developer direct event is like, hey, they're gonna focus on stuff, all three games that like I'm interested in, so we'll see what happens.
Our next section of headlines that I threw here were sales updates. So obviously we use these just as kind of like launch, you know, springboards to other discussions around these games. A game that we've talked about, you know, pretty frequently since its release in the back half of last year, Digimon Story Time Stranger, obviously showed up on our, you know, Game of the Year cast as well back in early December. But since the last recording of the TetraCast, it did hit the 1 million copies sold mark. So real, real cool milestone for Digimon.
Yeah, and congratulations to them on that. Since then, you know, they've had one DLC out and one fairly soon that will feature like the Bancho Digimon. I think it's called like the Bantio group. So they'll have like Bancho Liamon, Bancho Stingmon, Bancho Lilimon, Bancho Mamemon, Bancho Golemon on the
I remember some of those were, you know, I think Bancho Leomon is in Time Stranger, but the rest aren't, if I remember right. I'm trying to remember.
Not Bancho Leomon.
He's not.
These are all new. Okay. Yeah. I think it might have been in Cyber Sleuth, but all the other Banchos, besides Bancho Leomon, usually don't, you know, get any representation in the games very rarely. So it's you know, exciting for people who like the Bancho Digimon. They'll have the full group.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Digimon to like speak to them, but yeah.
Yeah, so that'll be like at the end of January, I believe.
Square Enix over the last month have detailed a lot of the benchmarks that their games have hit in December and the January timeframe. So Final Fantasy Pixel Remaster, that series has sold over 6 million copies. They've also announced a release of a soundtrack CD set for Japan. That's going to launch in February. At least in the news post from December from Mikhail, I don't see details about a Western release of the CD set. So I'm not sure if that's been detailed by the Western branch of Square Enix since this announcement or not. But at least going to be available in Japan for importers or for those in that market. Final Fantasy Tactics, The Evilise Chronicles, has, since its release in September, hit the 1 million units milestone. Octopath Traveler, the console series, of course, we talked about Octopath Traveler Zero releasing in December. The Octopath Traveler series has surpassed 6 million units sold. When they say console series, I presume this means everything outside of Champions of the Continent, so 1, 2, and 0.
Yeah.
And then this one was in the footnote of the press release talking about the Dragon Quest VII Reimagined demo. This is a good spot by Mikhail and others. Is that Dragon Quest XI Echoes of an Elusive Age, since its release in 2018, whenever it came, had hit the 9 million units sold mark.
A lot of press releases, actually almost every press release, has like kind of like footnotes at the bottom, and usually they're just kind of fluffy. Like, for example, when Sega announces a new trailer for Yakuza Kiwami 3 and Dark Ties, there's usually a little blurb at the bottom that's like, the Yakuza series is well-loved around the world for its, you know, serious dramatic storylines and blah, 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 blah. And usually it's pretty easy to just gloss over that. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But sometimes they do sneak these little nuggets in there, like this Dragon Quest one. It's like, Dragon Quest 11 has sold 9 million copies. And like, that was just never announced. They just kind of sneak it in that little footnote. So that's where it came from.
And the last sales update I have is that Spike Chunshoft has announced that the Danganronpa series in total has sold 10 million units worldwide. And of course, for 2026, the big release in that space is the Danganronpa 2x2, 2x2, 2x2. I forget what the actual stylization of that is, but 2x2. I haven't listed every single date here because a lot of the dates since we last covered, we're in the section where we go over like upcoming release dates, update dates, those sorts of things, have already come to pass in late December, early January. Here's one that I saw that I immediately was like, oh, I completely missed this over the break because it was announced just a few days after Christmas, is that Granblue Fantasy, the original game, is going to be available on PC through Steam officially on March 10th. Josh and Chow, what do we think about this?
This is a really weird release because the biggest footnote on this is like existing accounts cannot be linked with the Steam version. So all the pre-existing accounts, both you know, in Japan and obviously a lot of people around the world internationally still do play the Granblue Fantasy game. Even though it's quote unquote technically available only in Japan, you can access it. And it has like a full, it supports English as well. You can just like flip on a setting in the option setting in that game to have all its menus be in English. So a lot of international players have been playing this game for a long time, and to have this be available via Steam but cannot use their existing accounts really puts into question like what the state of the upcoming Steam release is going to be on March 10. Whether it's going to be just parody content complete like what it is in Japan already, whether it's going to be on that, or if they're going to start from the very beginning again, like what they did with Uma Musume's global release. And that's going to be pretty awkward if they're going to do that, if they're going to do the Uma Musume style, hey, we're going to launch this like how we launched it in 2013, but we're going to go at an accelerated pace for this 12-year-old game, which is going to be miserable. Because
yeah, whenever a game goes on an accelerated pace, it never seems to turn out well.
Especially if it's 12 years old. And this is the sort of game, especially you would know, Chow, like this is a game that's very much a marathon that has like a lot of like wells of grinding.
There's a lot of grind in this game. I know it sounds bad, but it's like, okay, this material will take you like 300 fights to get one or whatever, and then you add up all these materials to upgrade, and it's like, yeah, you're not going to get that in a single day. You know, just like, you just kind of slowly build it up over time, and you know, and then you get it, right? And then it feels satisfying at the end of the day. But to do that as a new player, ooh, I don't know how you would get through that, right? So it's just like...
Yeah, there's a game that has like weapon grids where you have like a main weapon, and then you have like nine other weapons that like kind of bolster this weapon's attributes and its elemental affinities and so forth, and you have to like, you know, want to max out those weapons, and the quote unquote best weapons and best characters are always going to be rotating because Granblue frequently adds like new characters that power creep, you know, prior characters.
They haven't gotten that bad. I think the strongest characters are still from 2 years ago, but they're grand units, or like they're like premium limited units still. But they like the strongest unit, in my opinion, are still like from 2 years ago, right? Not like the latest meta. I don't think they want to like make all the new characters like completely
old. But when you think about that, like, but when you think of like, hey, they're two from 2 years old, so they're like 10 to 11 year old characters. And so if you watch this fresh, you know, they're still. The relatively frequent from the current state of the game.
It was fresh, man. I played the game from the beginning. Like, me and my friend was talking about it. It's like, oh yeah, it's like, what do you think of Grand Zeta? Grand Zeta is like one of the most overpowered fire characters. And you can like compare like a character at launch at the day. It's like they could barely do like 100,000 damage versus like the current characters could do like 50 million all in like a span of a few seconds, right? Like, man, the game has gone long ways.
So I don't really know, like, no one really knows what the state of this game is going to be when it launches on Steam.
I'm sure it has all the content. I think they just wanted to release a Steam version after seeing their success from Musume, so they just made, like a quick Steam version to try to capitalize on that momentum. But I don't think it'll do anything. I think the market audience is already either they are playing it on the browser. And
like what does the new user, what new player experience even what does that even look like in modern Granblue stuff? Like if I'm a new player to Granblue and I just wanna log in and play Granblue Fantasy for the first time, what the fuck does that even look like?
You know? Right now the current new player experience, they add this called the Nixhack Academy, which gives you like all these like weapon grids completed from like the first 2-tier raids, so you're kind of technically like mid game right from the get go, right? And
okay, but think about like how much story content that they have to go through, and how much
they also offer a story skip too. It's like there's a story skip button, you could just click on it, and then it's like, oh, you get 10,000 gems, and now you can do all the new raids. But do you want to skip
the story? But what if you want to like understand like the main story?
And then you have to read it then.
Yeah, exactly, right? So you're just gonna have like this like
190... Wait, there's like 200 chapters now, I think. It's like, I got to like 100, like...
But think about like, if you want to like read this, the main story to understand like who these characters are and what their motivations are, but then you'll have like this quote-unquote mid-level account because of like all the free stuff that they give you.
So you're just basically... I don't worry about that. Because like the main story is only focused on the main cast of characters. If you want like all these other characters, then you will just do the events. The events that they show up, they appear in, is like where you get to know them the most, because they don't appear in the main story, right?
If people want like to like, you know, play the game, you know, and understand what they're doing in the game, and you just want to progress to the main story, if you're just giving all these freebies to get this powered up account, you're just basically spamming auto battles for God knows how many hours to get through the main story, you know, just to read it.
The main story doesn't have too many battles, and I don't think it's like that difficult. I think it was just like bad when the game first started with all the
events. I mean, my main point here, Chow, is you're just gonna be mindlessly steamrolling. There's gonna be like no sense of challenge whatsoever for.
I feel like it's long. Like a Final Fantasy XIV experience. If you play Final Fantasy XIV, the main story is like piss easy. You could have a baby play those raids and then you'll win through it, right? And then it's like, if you want to do the challenging content, that's where the raid or like the savage tier difficulty comes in, you know, or extreme challenge, you know. It's like, but I feel like story is just kind of made easy so you can enjoy reading the story, because the story is a visual novel basically, right? So I don't think that's a concern of mine, really.
I don't know, it just feels like it's like, who cares about playing this game at all? Who cares?
No, I just feel like the story is just made to be easy so you can enjoy reading it, right? It's just for like story enjoyers, right? But if you want the challenging content is there, and you could do it, right? It's just...
Yeah, if you just want to try to do like hundreds of thousands of hours of grinding to do it, what? Yes. Yep, I don't know. Right. It's kind of like a weird thing. We'll see what happens when this releases on Steam. It's kind of like a weird thing because
it's still my favorite gacha game, but you know, it's hard to like expect people to go through that grind, you know, to get through it. You know, I think it just has like it scratches a lot of itch. Obviously, like these days, it's like the game's been a little bit too pay to win hungry these days. They keep selling these like banners, like, hey, pay us $50 and you get these things instantly, or pay us $30 and you can get the limited characters. Like, they keep having like these non-stop like sales ever since like KMR stepped down. KMR used to be the producer.
Kimura.
Yeah, so the new guy hasn't even shown his face yet. He keeps using like this AI generated voice with like enjoy talking in like live stream shows. He hasn't shown his face, and these days the game feels like it's been a little bit marketing too much into the pay to win side.
I guess we'll see how this new interface goes as well. Like, you know,
it's a browser game. It's going on for 12 years. So it's like, this is kind of to be expected. And there's probably less care on like the balance of characters as time goes on, right? Like, I see with different gacha games, like, I don't know, like Epic 7, for example. It's like, there's like no balance with current state of the game. It seems like they're all focusing on different gacha game that they made, which was like Chaos Zero Nightmare or something. I don't know. It's something like that.
Well, I mean, the side games isn't like developing that.
I mean, I know, but I'm just saying, like, in here,
they have other things. Princess Connect, Shadowverse.
Like, it just doesn't feel like it's their main thing, right?
So I don't want to like confuse people. Like, no, Chaos Zero Nightmare is not related to Psych.
No, of course not. But I'm just saying, from different developers' experiences, like, yeah, it seems like they're focusing their priorities on different things, right? And that's how I feel with the side games. Like, oh, Uma Musume became a big thing, and now Kimura has to step down, and he has to focus on that.
Is Uma Musume on Steam?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But it's like it's a different server, so it's not like it's not shared progress with the Japanese
release of the game. I feel like they're not gonna start from scratch. I think you just have all the content right away, and you just have to make a Steam account to play it, and then if you have the old existing account, it's you're just screwed. I guess.
We'll see. No one knows until that game comes out at this point.
I think they said they just don't have the rights to it because they use a Movich accounting service or DMM or Yahoo or whatever, and they just don't have the rights to that. That's why you're forced to start from scratch. At least that's my general like understanding from what some other players' speculation are.
But like, nothing is set in stone. Like, we don't know. There's no confirmed info, what I'm saying, like, based on reporting. All right, what's our last news story, Brian?
All right, this one is the last date that I have listed, is that we got an announcement for Diablo 4 second expansion, Lord of Hatred. It's coming out on April 28th. And then if you pre-ordered, I hope I get the details right, if you pre-ordered the specific Ultimate Edition for this, you could access the Paladin class ahead of time. So you can play the Paladin class now in Diablo 4 if you pre-purchase the Lord of Hatred Ultimate Edition. Plus, you get skins for WoW and a few other things. Go ahead.
I think the first expansion, which is Vessel of Hatred, is also included in Lord of Hatred. So it's like you actually, if you did not buy Vessel of Hatred, you actually, like, in terms of like pure money spent, come out on top, because now you can just skip buying it altogether and just buy the second expansion. You get the first expansion with it.
And I've seen that before with like when games end up with like 4, 5, 6 expansions, they start bundling the earlier ones together like that. It as a concept is not new,
yeah,
but this is quicker than you normally see it, where as soon as expansion 2 is announced, expansion 1 is bundled in. Like, huh, that's okay. It does kind of feel, and maybe I'm missing something in the details here, but it does kind of feel like, oh, if I had just waited, I would have saved $30 or whatever, because it's included. And it's even included, let me make sure, it's included in the Lord of Hatred Ultimate, it's included in the Lord of Hatred Deluxe, and is included in Lord of Hatred Standard Edition. Yeah, it's in there.
Vessel
of Hatred.
Oh, wow.
So you only get the Paladin, though, if you do Deluxe or Ultimate. So, yeah, like, I'm looking at this news post from December, and I'm like, this is one of those things where you almost need, like, a table of what you get.
Yeah, use that sticker that some game developers and publishers use under infographic tables of, like, best value.
Yeah. And I remember playing through Vessel of Hatred in like an afternoon, because I only did the critical path, and felt like it really ended on like not even a cliffhanger. That's too much credit. If it ended where I was like, oh, wait, I swore that was the penultimate fight. There's supposed to be one more, right? At least. And it just ended. So, and I know like playing Diablo for the story is not how most people play it, but that's all the time I had given for it. So I'm curious to see what the Diablo player base feels about this, because Vessel of Hatred seems like it wasn't that well received, but I'm also admitting that I'm not as tuned in as I could be in terms of what that player base thinks. But that'll be coming out in late April. And that was not absolutely everything announced between second week of December and now. If you do want to see absolutely everything, go to rpgsite.net, hit that news tab, and then just start clicking through, because Mikhail, Adam, Josh, and others have done a real good job of getting all the new dates, all the new trailers that have been announced, both like at the Game Awards and, you know, released on the publisher's different individual social media channels. So we have all those, and you know, from this point, we'll be able to check in on a weekly basis with our podcast about all the RPG news for 2026. All of those reviews, previews, and interviews that we talked about are all up on the site at rpgsite.net. Just hit the articles tab and you should be able to filter to all of those. You can find RPG Site on all the social media networks. Just search for RPG Space Site on Facebook, Twitter, Blue Sky. I'm sure I'm forgetting some others. We have a Steam Curator page. Join our Discord. discord.gg/RPGsite. You should be able to join us there or hit the link at the top of our homepage. If you like listening to this podcast, leave a comment on the site post, leave a rating on whatever podcast service of choice you listen to us through. We'd like to see those. And we'll be back next week and hopefully every week in 2026 with new episodes of the Tetracast. Before we close out fully, any other final comments from you, Adam, or you, Josh?
No, I mean, it's going to be an interesting year, you know. It's a lot of interesting titles to look forward to. And to all our listeners, you know, thank you for your support, you know. We get a lot of, like, kind comments, especially on the Discord, and we always appreciate people listening in. If you really want to, like, you know, contact us directly, Discord is the best way to do that. I regularly, you know, chat with our community members and have fun with them, seeing what they're up to. It's going to be a fun year.
Adam? You can just say no comment if you got nothing.
It is cruel. It is cruel to me specifically that Neo 3 and Dragon Quest 7 Reimagined basically release on the same day.
Yeah. Next week, we'll probably go into more... We will certainly go into more detail for the full release of Trails Beyond the Horizon. Shortly after that, in February, we'll go into Dragon Quest and Neo and others. And from there, we'll carry it forward. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. Thanks for tuning into the Tetracast, and we'll talk to y'all later.